Okay, it is July 10th, 2021. I am David Knight. I'm going to be the moderator of our journey meeting on the Trail of Truth and the JFK assassination today. It is 1 o'clock on the dot, and I want to welcome everybody that you know, has showed up for our event. We're going to have Casey Quinlan talk for a little bit today. I hope we can hear from Larry Snaff and see what he's been up to on the legal side. There's Larry for waving at everybody. And Brian may have a few pieces to add to it as well. So with that, let's go ahead and start the meeting. I want to thank everybody that's in attendance for attending our previous showing that was known as the Spotlight Series of the Journey Meeting with Dr. John Newman. In case anybody is interested in numbers, I'd always like to see how we're doing. We had, let me look here, we had a total of 416 views, and most everybody on the analytics shows that they watched the discussion and the video all the way through of Dr. Newman's first night, and 362 people have seen the second night event. So, plus we had about 133 people sign up for the meeting, and a little under 100 showed up for it. So I think we had good numbers with that, and we're going to continue doing more Spotlight Series videos or more Spotlight presentations with guest speakers focused on one presenter and their presentation they want to give. I do not have the person lined up for July. I'm hoping that we will still have a Spotlight Series meeting for July. It may be the last week of July before we get it done, but as soon as I have information about it, then we will put that up on the website, and I will send out emails to everybody. All right. Now, today, of course, everybody, you can unmute your microphones. You can join in the conversations. Those that attended Dr. Newman's presentation realized that the chat feature was not active. Let's make sure that we have the chat feature turned on for everybody here. All right. Everyone, publicly and directly. So, chat feature is turned on. So anybody that likes to share things in the chat log, remember those chat logs are posted on our website along with the MP4 videos posted to YouTube and the MP3 downloads that you can download from our website and take with you on your devices. There we go. So let's see. Well, something else special today. Casey Quinlan is now on his own at his own place. He is not sitting right next to me, so we're going to have Casey give a little presentation, and with that, I'm going to turn over to him, and then I will interject back in throughout the meeting today. So, Casey, go ahead and take it away.
All right, David, I want to make sure, can everybody see me, and can everybody see the beginning of this PowerPoint?
Well, we can see you. Make sure that you share your screen.
Okay, let's see if I got it here.
Okay, we see your desktop.
Yeah, I'm gonna share my cable right out here. Okay. Do you see it? Do you see it now, David?
Yeah, we're actually seeing the presenter view. So if you want to show full screen on your deal, it's going to be the other screen you want to share.
Okay, let me get this. So am I dragging it over?
Yeah, just drag it over, and then
all right, hold on.
Bear with him, folks. This is his first day on his own, so we all have to go to school. And
God, no kidding.
And you know what? If it's going to happen, it's going to happen live.
You darn right it's going to happen live. Okay, now. I have one screen where I don't have anything up, and then this one I just have. So I'm going to drag. What am I dragging over, David?
Well, you're not really going to drag over, but you're going to open up the actual PowerPoint window that shows the PowerPoint main screen, not the presenter mode.
Casey, on your PowerPoint, pull your PowerPoint program up and then change the view to normal viewing instead of presenter mode. There's three or four choices on the program to choose the view.
I hear you, but I don't see where it is.
Open up your PowerPoint slide on your desktop. I see it at the bottom. Open that up. Double click that, and it'll open it up. Yeah, right there.
Okay, I've got the PowerPoint opened up on one, but I don't have it on the one that I have my other computer screen up.
Then go ahead and drag it over to your main screen where you're at. It's not on one, it's going to be on the other. There you go.
Okay. That's what I was thinking about doing, but I thought I'd put it on both of them. Okay, let's see what we got here.
Click from the beginning.
Let me see if I got this correct. Now it just flipped again. Why did it do that?
Well, let's see here. Hold on. Let's see what I can do to help you out. Go up there to where it says display settings.
Click okay.
On that. Swap presenter view and slideshow. There you go.
Okay.
Now go ahead and start.
Okay, let me double check here. Okay, what I'm seeing over here. Okay, I think I got it here. All right, guys, it's good to have students like David, and David was my student. God forbid now I'm his student. But that's okay. That's great. That's what this whole thing's about. I've had a lot of people ask questions about who is Project JFK, how do we get started, what's going on with all of this. And so let me just give you kind of about a 14-point PowerPoint program, and let's tell you who we are. Well, first of all, JFK came into our lives as a visionary. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. His murder closed the gate to American democracy and opened the door to the fanatic fascism that has infested our country today. Now, that particular slide was written a long time ago, but I tell you what, I think it's, for the most part, it kind of parallels what's going on today, and I'm not sure if JFK would turn over in his grave if he saw what was going on in the United States today. Conspiracy phobia. Those who suffer from conspiracy phobia are fond of saying, do you actually think there's a group of people sitting around in a room plotting things? For some reason, that image is assumed to be so patently absurd as to invite only disclaimers. But where else would people of power get together? On park benches or carousels? Indeed, they meet in rooms, corporate boardrooms, Pentagon command rooms, at the Bohemian Grove, in the choice dining rooms at the best restaurants, resorts, hotels, and estates, in the many conferences at the White House, the National Security Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, or whatever. And yes, they consciously plot, though they call it planning and strategizing. And they do so in great secrecy, often resisting all efforts at public disclosure. No one contemplates and plans more than political and corporate elites and their hired specialists. To make the world safe for those who own it, politically active elements of the owning class have created a national security state, that expends billions of dollars and enlists the efforts of vast numbers of people. Now, that comes from Professor Michael Perenni, and I know a lot of you who are doing research on the murder of JFK over the past number of years have read Dr. Perenni and know exactly who he is. Facts matter, along with complicated truths. Welcome to the fascinating world of research into the 58-year-old murder of President John F. Kennedy. The research into the murder of President Kennedy by many dedicated individuals has brought us to the edge of the frontier. It exposes the men and the institutions who targeted President Kennedy. It uncovers the design of this execution. It examines the plan and concept for the operation. It confirms who composed the orders to facilitate this murder and reveals some of the participants in the Dallas operation on November 22, 1963. For the past 58 years, that's what a lot of us as researchers have been trying to do, try to expose this. And little by little, bits and pieces of this are coming out. President John F. Kennedy. I had a former English teacher write this for me, and his name's Charles Galladay. So he took the word assassination, and this is what he came up with. Always question. Stories can be altered, sometimes made up completely, all to fit an agenda. Secrets can be kept. Suspects just imagined. Identifying the truth is tricky. Nothing is as it seems. All is an illusion. Truth, the second victim. It must not be allowed. Only the courageous battle on, needing to expose the truth. And I think this was very appropriate as he put this out. Well, we are Project JFK. We're an investigative research and speakers bureau. And let me introduce you. Most of you already have heard and seen who we are, but I'm Casey Quinlan, along with Brian Edwards and obviously David Knight. Project JFK began as a theme-oriented concept within the teaching framework of American history and U.S. government courses in 1975. The legacy of political assassinations in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, and America's entrance into the Vietnam War became employable topics. This model was designed to introduce students to a target of reading and research with the comprehension and perceptions of American history and the inclusion and study of law represented within the United States Constitution. This was the driving force behind this educational instrument. By 1977, this educational methodology was brought into middle-level and high school classrooms. It was used to enlighten students in making history come alive. The murder of President Kennedy became the platform for the creation of Project JFK. It was the educational vehicle utilized to provide students with a hands-on experience in the accomplishment of reading, writing, and research of contemporary American history. This vehicle generated a journalistic fervor for each student. It fostered a personal point of view with an understanding of American history and constitutional law. It included a two-week theme, thematic approach, if you want, on the murder of President Kennedy, historical background of the politics of the 1960s, geographical concepts of Dealey Plaza, the kill zone, eyewitness reports, the Warren Commission documents and hearings, the science of ballistics, weapons, and projectiles, the mathematics and the comprehension of speed, sound, wind, and area, a comprehensive test over crime scene data, a weekend trip and tour of the crime scene in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas, introduction of eyewitnesses within the scope of the crime scene, and individual classroom presentations on this historic experience. By 1989, Project JFK became Project JFK CSI Dallas, and it included Hold on just a second. Got a little technical difficulty on my end, but we'll get it. All right. All right. It included the investigation and analysis of the crime scene in Dealey Plaza and the presidential limousine. In 2010, Project JFK CSI Dallas became a global search engine, providing investigative research and a speakers bureau. This organization has become the number one research engine for collection and dissemination of materials collected to the assassination of President Kennedy. It includes a warehouse of related facts, documents, pictures, videos, films, and memorabilia. With 145 years of combined research, it has become the best independent arena for continued research and stories on the murder of President John F. Kennedy. Last year, we were one of the first, if not the first, to present a live global JFK research conference hosted by us on the weekend of November 14th and 15th. And due to the COVID-19 virus, with traveling and social distancing restraints, we offered this global live virtual webinar as the first time in our history, in history alone. And so far, we've had overwhelming amount of people who have come forward and said, this is fantastic. We want to do this the entire time. But I will say that there's nothing like going to the actual scene of the crime and walking over the area where a number of eyewitnesses who are still alive today, not very many, but there are a number of them, and who are still coming forward trying to tell their story. Project JFK CSI Dallas, we presented a new program, added a new program, and that was The Journey. And we're on the trail of the truth of the JFK assassination. It is a monthly gathering and sharing of ideas and research in the case from 1963 to right now, to the current. So we are currently on that program right now, and just recently we came up with what is known as the Spotlight Series. And our Spotlight Series featured John Newman and presented about four or five chapters of his new book, which is coming out later on this year. And in our Spotlight Series, as well as in our programs that we are, especially the Journey program, it is hosted by Project JFK, and our key host is David Knight. So we are Project JFK, CSI Dallas. Real quick before we get out of here, and I'll turn it back over to any questions or anything you guys would like to ask. I was a teacher for 40 years at the high school level and about 15 years at the college and junior college level. Brian Edwards, I met him after doing a series of Kennedy presentations at Johnson County Community College, and he sat up in front and asked so many questions, I had to sit back and say, who are you? At that particular time, I didn't know if he was FBI, CIA, or somebody with maybe just a realistic person who wanted to know some answers. And so Brian and I have been real close buddies for the last 35 to almost 40 years, and we put together programs, which we call Project JFK. Then later on, we presented most of these at high school and the college level. And every once in a while, we would pick up a student that was really interested in this. And so that's how David Knight came about. David was one of our students, and he fit in with us. And he went to almost every Project JFK conference that we had, and went to Dallas probably for the last 30 years. And it was one of those things where it's kind of neat that you have a student who is now the technical advisor and the technical person that puts these programs together, and he is the host. And I hate to say that Brian and I are getting old, but I'll just say I'm getting old. But not as old as Larry now. So, actually, Larry, I'm a little bit older, but that's all right. But I just wanted to present this to you guys primarily because we are Project JFK. And so with that, I'm going to let you guys know that I'm trying to get back into the teaching field at high school, and I just want to let you know, I just applied for a job, and I want to show you what is out there and what you have to answer as a teacher, okay? I applied for a social studies job, but my main course would be teaching United States government, which I've done many times. So this is what happened. When I went for the interview, I asked a question, and they said, we want you to teach this, but you can't teach anything about the Second Amendment, okay? Then they said, you can't talk about the former presidential election that we just had. You can't talk about critical racism theory. And for God's sakes, I asked them about the possibility of putting sex education together with driver's ed, and they cut that down pretty damn quick. But I'm not really sure. I threw that in as a laugh, but the last three things, or the last three things we talked about, no. I could not believe that they said I couldn't teach Second Amendment rights. I couldn't teach anything about the last election, and also about critical racism theory. And I'm sitting there going, good God, you know what? I don't think I want to teach. But that's what's driving me right now. I want to get in and teach it, but I don't want to be micromanaged by what is going on in our society today. So what I will do there is I will end right there and let you guys know that I'm still going to go out and see if I can teach maybe at a junior college or college. But at the same time, if this is what we're up against, especially in education, well, I know what we're up against in some other areas, and I'm sure that Larry and Bill could answer some of that on the level of what's going on in the federal government. So, guys, I wanted to take up just a few minutes of your time and introduce you to who we are, because I know we started off and we're going full force now over a year, and so thank you guys for participating in this, and I'll turn it over back over to Dave, and we'll go from there, maybe open up some questions.
All right, thanks, Casey. The big thing is since there's a lot of pushback, I guess you would say, from actually being able to teach on the teaching side in the public school districts, even some charter schools too. I know it was different from when I was in school. I'm sure for a lot of us it was different from when we were in school. They actually taught about subjects and subject matter that, you know, today it's totally taboo. So by having something that we're doing now of a monthly journey meeting, spotlight series, I just spoke with Casey the other night, and I said, you know what? I said, I understand that we may not be able to teach some of the stuff in school. I've went and spoke at junior highs and high schools and also on the college level, junior college. And I said, there's always that little pushback of going, okay, just what the hell are you going to be talking about? We need to know what's your notes, what's your curriculum that you're going to be teaching or telling these students. So by doing it here, I said, you know, what about doing a course curriculum, maybe something on like what Stone had put out with the Untold Truth and Untold History of the United States. I said, we're already teaching things that aren't being taught in school at our conferences, and I said that I think that's a great way to reach students as well. And just because they may not show up live, that doesn't mean that they aren't going to go obviously to the YouTube channel, because the kids today, I know my kids are the same way. They're big on YouTube, social media, so that's where we put things out at, so that way people can view it that way. It also gives, some kids maybe the chance to, wake the hell up and find out what's really, gone on. Because when it comes to history, it's that dead subject. It's the boring subject. And it's not boring at all. It can be exciting to learn about. I know when I was a youngster in school, yeah, history was not one of my favorite subjects. Then it became presidential history, political history. That's when, you know, thanks to Casey, it opened up doorways that I didn't know existed, because I was too busy doing everything else, from sports to extracurriculars, girls, you name it. I think we can reach the generation that the younger generation right now by doing what we're continuing doing, by offering the series and meetings and shows that we're putting together. So yeah, good job on that, Casey. Appreciate that. Brian, do you have anything you'd like to add before I turn it over to Larry to hear about his updates?
No, I think he pretty much capitalized told everybody what we're doing. We're still forging ahead with the Dick Russell collection. Hopefully we'll have that up online, hopefully by the end of the summer. And Baylor is probably going to give us some more documents to take a look at as far as putting it on our website. So that's pretty much what we're working on, and trying to get some more collections from Gary Shaw and whoever else wants to donate it to our website. We're certainly agreeable to anything that anybody wants to put up that they might have, if they want to share it with anybody. So you know how to get a hold of us. If you want something on our website that, you know, obviously would give you credit for it, but if you want to share with others, that's kind of what our goal is, to share as much information with everybody.
All right, yeah, definitely. And throw a quick shout out to Randy Sterling for giving us when we were doing the Spotlight series this past couple weeks. And again, everybody that donates or wishes to donate, they can go to productgfk.com, click on the donate button on the homepage, and get your name thrown up there on the wall as one of our supporters. And it can be a small donation, it can be a large donation. Hell, we take both. But it also helps with the work that we're doing, and what we continue to do. So running the website, running the shows, paying for Zoom equipment to get the document scanned. And I can tell you right now, and I know I say this quite often, but when it comes to the Dick Russell collection, the things that are in there and getting a chance to actually view what's in there, when you guys do get a chance to see it, and I don't know if Baylor's going to put it up first or if we're just going to go ahead and put it up. It's kind of a talk we're doing with Mary Goolsby. I think they're going to try to get it on their system first, but we'll definitely have it on ours. And when you guys get a chance to peruse through those items, you're going to be well happy with the quality that we've gotten from his scans and digitizing. And it'll open up a new doorway to some things that maybe have been lost over time. There's a lot of good information in there for everybody to view and to research from. So I'm going to go ahead and give the floor to Larry. And Larry, why don't you give us an update on how things are going on your side of the world?
Okay, thanks, David. And by the way, Casey, I teach at New York Law School, and a number of my colleagues have stopped teaching the Dred Scott decision, which is the decision, for those who don't remember, where the Supreme Court allowed a slave to be brought back to the South. And they don't teach that course now because they're afraid that it's going to offend their students. And it's remarkable that a case which stands for the proposition that just because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's moral, right? Or legal, that means it's moral, is not being taught in some places because they're afraid that they're going to hurt the feelings of the students. So I don't know, you know, if you don't learn to deal with uncomfortable topics in school, how are you going to learn to do it in real life? But that's, you know, I'll step off my soapbox on that one. our group is continuing to work on our effort to get the records released. We're just about finalized our legal memo and our cover letter to the president. Our aspirational goal is to send it out by this Friday. We're asking the president to revoke the Trump executive memorandum that he issued, authorizing a 3-year postponement, also asking him to direct the agencies to immediately comply with the act. And for those few records that might actually satisfy the clear and convincing test under the JFK Act, requires that the agencies demonstrate to a clear and convincing level, which is almost like, you know, 90%. It's almost like beyond a reasonable doubt that the record poses a risk to national security, and that risk outweighs the public interest in having the record released. We're asking them, if there are, in fact, such documents, that they, as required by the JFK Act, publish the reasons so that the American people can see. The person that's probably going to review the letter and memo, even though it's addressed to the president, is probably going to be the new deputy counsel at the NSC, who we've learned is a friend of one of the members of our group, has a complete blank slate on this issue. He doesn't know anything about the JFK Records Act. So that's a good thing, because he is now coming, he'll be coming at this without any preconceived notions. So we're going to finalize the letter by tomorrow, and then we're going to start the process of contacting people to add their name to the letter. We're starting with the list that signed the letter to the PIDB, the Public Interest Declassification Board, and then we'll try to add to that. And by the end of the week, we hope to be able to get this to the president. And once that happens, then, you know, we'll wait a reasonable amount of time and see what the response is. Obviously, the president right now is consumed with budgetary issues. So, you know, we figure probably, you know, August is when they're going to really be focusing on the budget. So hopefully by the end of August, we'll have some response from him. We also are following up with NARA. I had submitted a FOIA request asking for all the documents that there was apparently an exchange of documents between NARA and the Office of the President and obviously the agencies about the compliance of the JFK Act in 2017 and 2018. No one has seen those papers. We don't know if what they did was what ARP did, like with the CIA, when Doug Horn had told us in one of our prior meetings that the ARP staff had gone to the CIA's office and just had a meeting, and they reviewed the objections orally and didn't put anything in writing. But we know there's at least one memo and possibly two that were written from the NSC's counsel to the agencies explaining how to comply with the act. And then we have letters from NARA to the president indicating, you know, concerns about the way they're responding. Well, where's the underlying documentation? Was that orally or was that in writing? So we put a request in. I had requested an expedited review, and that got denied. But we're going to continue to move on that topic as well in August. Also going to recircle back with Congress. Congress, like the president, is a bit somewhat consumed with the budgetary issues now. And we're also going to follow with the PIDB, because they said they would be working with NARA over the summer. So those are things we're going to be doing once we get the letter out. The letter right now to the president is our principal focus, and we're hoping to get it out by the end of the week. David, I may contact you offline for some, we're thinking maybe getting Dick Russell to sign the letter, and then maybe some other people that I may need, you know, you to help to do some outreach.
Sure, no problem.
Bill, you have anything you want to add? Bill Sipich?
Yeah,
Bill, your microphone's on mute.
Yeah, I had a phone call. I had to get off the phone call. Anyway, I think Larry did a good job summarizing it. I think we're going to make them either cough up these documents about why they're what their objections are based on and over the summer, or we're going to have to file a lawsuit as to why. I got to get off for a minute. I got to finish this phone call, but that's my two cents.
Yeah, and we've already, you know, we started working on a legal memo for that action. But we meet every Friday except for the July 4th weekend. So we have five people that are doing different tasks. So we're quite capable of, we're probably going to have to file a law. If we file a lawsuit, it'll be in October or, and obviously September is going to be the time when the decision is made in October as to whether to release, but there's a lot of stuff that's going to have to happen in September, review of documents, back and forth. So that's going to be the critical time period. And what we also, the women that wrote the book, Texas Speaks, Katriana and Sarah, they are going to be signing on to our letter. And in exchange for that, their PR group is going to help promote the fact that this letter has been sent to the president. So hopefully we will get some press out of this. And we're also thinking about, right, you know, before the deadline, maybe trying to schedule a presser at the National Press Club or something, some event to get the media's attention to put more pressure on the party. We want to make it harder for them to deny release than to make it, than to release the documents. So I think that is about it.
Okay, Larry. Well, speaking of, press and everything, I've noticed that in the news, we're kind of, the JFK research community has started to come back a little bit more into the limelight, at least in just the last week alone. Again, this is the 30th anniversary since the movie JFK came out. And I know Oliver Stone is premiering his new movie at the Cannes Festival. I believe it's the 12th, 13th, and 14th, I believe is where it's, is the dates of it. So I know that's been making the news. And I know that I saw on Facebook just the other day, Jim DiEugenio had put out a thing that he was on a two-hour phone call with someone making another documentary on the JFK assassination. I don't see the, well, of course, I don't have the Facebook thing pulled up on my computer, but if you go to Facebook and pull up Jim DiEugenio, you can see the post that he made. But I know that, you know, we're starting to get that little bit of kind of an oomph again. I know that we've had some people looking at what we're doing as well. So I think that I think we're moving in the right direction by getting getting as much press or people to look at what we're doing and what's going on around us right now. During the 30th anniversary of JFK, let's kind of try to ride that wave a little bit to get people to take notice. It's kind of like in November every year we seem to kind of, as some people say, we crawl out of the woodwork together, which, the hell with the woodwork and crawling out. We're out front and center monthly. We don't wait until just November to do what we're doing. I think it's important that we do get together, and it shows by the views that we have on YouTube and on the website that people are watching what we're doing, and I think that's a good thing. We're not doing anything that would be tinfoil hat wearing shit. So, I'm happy for that. But, I think with what Larry's doing in his group is very, very important. And anything that you want to forward to me, and I'm thinking actually making a new section on the website of just, the community in the law section, so that way people can start seeing things posted as quickly as what you're what you guys are working on. So, and if you ever have any meetings that maybe have like a transcript or something of what took place that maybe, you know, we're not privy to, but you would like to have out there, I'm all for putting that up there as well. So,
we'll send you the when the letter goes out, we'll certainly post it. With the memorandum. I want to mention that also that I've been getting, I guess somehow I got enrolled in this Q-U-O-R-A listserv or something.
Oh, Quora, yeah.
Quora, yeah. And there's a whole bunch of JFK boards, I guess, maybe you call them. And it really is amazing how many people, and particularly lawyers, try to use their status as a lawyer to try to advance their personal feelings. And there is a whole bunch of people that really are promoting the lone gun theory, and you know, I've been pushing back different ways, but to the extent that people here that regularly listen to this, it'd be good to have a couple of people that are knowledgeable, you know, provide some inputs. Some people aren't going to listen, but there's other people that are persuadable, you know. I actually turned the screws on the lawyer that was arguing that every time I would say something, he would say bullshit. And I said to him, surely, he said he's a 31-year trial attorney. I said, well, if Bill Simbich and I could get a hung jury, you know, and five other teams of attorneys could get hung juries or acquittals over the course of 50 years, certainly you, if you were asked to defend Oswald, could probably get, I mean, you're probably as good as any of the attorneys that did this, except for me, David Boies. And he shut right up after that. He hasn't said a word after that.
Wow.
But, yeah, there's still a lot of stuff out there, and I see that the Wicked Witch side.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, so, anyway. So I'll send you that stuff, Casey. And it's, David, if there's any other legal developments that we are aware of, you know, we'll let you know so you can post that.
Okay, that sounds great. That sounds great, Larry, and thank you for the update. And keep fighting the fight. Well, let's see. I don't know if Bill, are you on the phone still, or are you with us?
Looks like he might be on the phone someplace, Dave.
Okay, well, I know it's always nice to have Larry and Bill give us insight of what goes on, not only in their world, but what's going on around our world that we, you know, maybe don't have the previous.
Well, David, what I can tell you is we studied the memo that was prepared. I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but the process for the 6-month delay was orchestrated. So NARA basically was put in the position of asking the president for an extension. And then the Office of Legal Counsel prepared a memo to support that request. And that memo, called the Gannon Memo, by the way, was written by the same attorney who prepared the executive order that implemented the Muslim ban right after the president became sworn into office. He only answered one question. He answered one section, Section 5G of the statute, and ignored the rest of the statute. And this is what lawyers can do, you know, you can play these games. So he ostensibly was asked one question, and he responded that the president had the authority under that section to have a 6-month delay, ignoring any other provision in the statute that would have had a countervailing provision or argument. Then when the president did the 3-year ban, he apparently relied on the same memo that only gave him the authority for a 6-month extension, not a 3-year extension. The rationale in that memo was, well, 6 months is really not going to affect the public interest that much. Very different from 3 years. So we're actually what we're trying to do is create a path. We're not focusing so much on Trump. We're focusing on the memo that the president relied on was wrong. And we're giving President Biden and his legal staff a pathway to change that decision. So we're looking at other sections of the statute that was not mentioned in that memo that says, no, you know, like for Section 11 basically says that this law trumps every other thing except for tax law. And in other words, if there is a basis under FOIA to withhold a document, say on grounds of deliberative process, well, that doesn't apply in the JFK Act because Section 11 says that JFK Act trumps FOIA. The reason they passed the law was because FOIA wasn't working. So we're trying to give them, if there's a willingness to do this, we're giving them a lot of paths to move forward. And that's what we're focusing on compliance with the law. But I just wanted you guys know that that memo was written very well. I mean, the person I wrote that was a former clerk of Scalia. And he is currently now a solicitor, an assistant solicitor general for the United States. So he's been rewarded. But that memo was very narrowly written on a single question, and that was then the basis for the president. But this whole thing was orchestrated. There's a request from NARA, then the lawyer, the Office of Legal Counsel, provides a memo saying yes, you can. Grant this request, and then the president does his executive memorandum. So the whole thing was a dance. And then they also did, and when they did the second time, there is a long-standing history that when a president issues an executive order or a memorandum, it first goes to the Department of Justice, Office of Legal Counsel, to review it. And that was not done in the 2018 extension. So there's a lot of things that were not complied with, and we're just pointing those out to the president. Sorry to like bore you with legal minutia, but just want to let you know what really went on.
Well, yeah, no, it's not a bore at all. There is, as a matter of fact, it's the insight that I think a lot of us, you know, would like to hear about. So that's why it's always great to have you, you know, in the meetings and giving us the 411 on the legal side of it. Because sometimes when I deal with lawyers a lot, and I'm like, okay. I had to kind of decipher just what the hell they're talking about. You know, you make it pretty well come out in plain English, you know, just what's going on and the information. It's not boring at all, so definitely we want to keep that part up. So definitely any time that you can join us, we definitely want to have you. Let's see. With that, I'm going to kind of open it up. That's the nice thing about the regular journey meetings compared to Spotlight is, you know, they're kind of a branch off of each other, but this one here, everybody gets a chance to get involved to talk about different things that are going on. So if anybody would like the floor to address anybody or address anything during this meeting, I will open it up now to anyone that would like to say something. All that you have to do is just unmute and tell me what you want to talk about.
I see Bart's here.
Yeah, I don't know if he's busy today or if he maybe was catching some much needed rest from working on the Malcolm Blunt stuff.
I'm very tired, in all honesty, and I went to Malcolm on Wednesday. And I've looked in the spreadsheet that I kept track of what I've been doing. And basically, I've had 2 days off in 3 months' time. That's 7 day weeks. So, can you all hear me?
Yeah, we hear you, Bart. Go ahead.
Okay. So, and I know I'm starting a new job on Monday. So it means that everything's gonna, well, I wouldn't say grind to a halt, but not far off it for now. I will only have time to work on bits in the evening. But the good thing is that the warehouse I'm working on is almost done because I managed to get a really good look in what's left in the warehouse, but also what's left at Malcolm's house. So, but the warehouse is going to go in September. One way or another, it's going to go. Whether it's going to be destroyed or whether it's going to be sent, I don't know yet. But what I do know is that I won't have access to it anymore. And I know there's only a few bags left for me. So the good thing is that. And the other thing is that I'm going to have probably one weekend. I'm going to go down there and one final look and take whatever needs to be taken. I've taken other stuff from Harry Livingston up in my attic right now just to keep that secure. And other than that, I've just been scanning, but it's really good stuff overall. There's too much to mention. And I did an interview with Malcolm. I just posted it on YouTube. I'll paste the link in. I posted it on Facebook, but I reckon some people are not on Facebook, so it gives them a chance to look at it. It was just an informal chat because, A, I couldn't be asked to prepare for it, and B, I just thought, you know what, this talk is going to resemble the archive, disorganized, and who knows what the next subject is in the next 2 minutes. So I have got just under an hour that is uploaded to YouTube, and anyone that starts bitching about the audio can, yeah. So yeah, it was a good talk because we talked just mishmash of stuff in generic terms of how we got the archive, this, that, and the other, but made me realize that we're going to have another one of those typical talks before I actually go into detail of the actual archive itself and the people that are mentioned in it. There is, I think that what Malcolm's archive exposes really well are the mechanics of how things were done with regards to correspondence between people, requests for documents, documents that have disappeared, documents that have been destroyed. So I'll go more into that in our next talk at some point next month. And I've also seen what's left at his house, and that gave me almost another headache because of the amount of material that's there. He's got about, I don't know, about 25 bags full left there. And I will gradually do that. But once I finish the warehouse, I'm going to take a break. Especially because I've got this new job. It's a 6-month contract. So I will only have time to work either in the evenings or in the weekends as such. And that's besides the house and the missus. So it will have to be equally attended to. And yeah, you know, I'll just see how it goes. But I want to work on my own stuff because that's another thing. I've got, you know, I keep finding documents that are in relation to what I'm doing. So, once that warehouse is done, I know there won't be much left with regards to my Dallas, materials and so forth. And, then I'm just going to work on my papers and that's going to take a few months. And then, I'm not going to get anything done before the anniversary. What I am going to be publishing, though, is the archives itself and the link to it. And that's going to keep people busy for quite some time. But those who are interested in it, at least, they will have to plow through a lot of material. I've mentioned this 2 or 3 times before already, that there's so much material that is not online, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I don't even dare what the percentage of it is now. Back then, I said, oh, it's between 10 and 20. But now I'm thinking it's between 20 and 40. So there's just so much stuff. And Joe knows best about this because he already said that there's about half that has been released as such. And that really reflects over all sections of the law enforcement agencies and the committees. I mean, maybe the church committee is one of the biggest ones that has a lot of missing documents, but there is also a lot of army stuff. And, you know, and then besides that, you just go into all the materials such as INS, U.S. Customs, things like that, who have quite a close and cushy connection with the Central Intelligence Agency. And there's very, very few documents of this Customs and INS basically available. Malcolm has got a few bits, but he knows that, you know, by reading other documents, he finds out that there are more documents available and so forth, but they've probably been destroyed as such. You know, that by itself, just looking at what's been destroyed and what's been, I don't know, lost and so forth is a massive job by itself, which I'm saying will clear off. Other people can go through the documents and figure it all out. But there's plenty to go for. And, yeah, so I know that I'm going to be – I've got about – I think about 8 bags left to do, so that's going to take me roughly about a month, but now it's going to take me longer, unless the jobs allows me to take documents into work and scan them on dead moments as such, but which I won't know until next week. But if I do, then that is what I will do. And then I'm going to, once I'm finished that, I'm going to put the little missing bits of the puzzle in the papers of mine and release them. Hopefully before Christmas, because the thing is I intend to release all 4 papers in one go. Again, it's just, I set myself the bar very high on with regards to the material, and so hopefully that's done, and then in the new year I just continue with scanning and stuff like that. So that's pretty much it. I don't know others what to talk about. I had somebody, I've got to write an article that needs to be done in about 10 days time. Fat chance. But the material is it's about an article for Garrison Magazine, and you know, so I just talked to it's going to be on a cover, nice portrait of Malcolm I took, and some other pictures of the collection all by itself. So it should be a really informative article, and I hope it entices people to check out the archive by that time when it comes out. I think it comes out just before the anniversary, and then that burden is done, because I want to, you know, I want to work on my own stuff for a change, because I basically I killed it off for at least 18 months. So, you know, and also I just wanted to have a fresh pair of eyes on my own work. So, and then, yeah, we continue with the archive and then hopefully be done, a year from now. Time allowing. I mean, it could be quicker, but I'm just thinking, like, well, the 6-month contract, if I do it right, then that's what it's going to be in my life for at least 6 months to a year. So, and I need it anyway, because I'm fucking penniless. So, and I just, you know, it's time to move on, and also constantly being, how do you say that? I'm almost like suffocating under the amount of paper that's basically around as such. So, who's messing with this mic? It's her mic. So, that's all I can say right now. I don't have any specifics. At some point, David, I will do little talks like Bill and others do, but I just don't have any time to prep for it, because I use every minute of the day 10 to 14 hours on documenting and reading things and scanning them in as such. So, like I said, I had 2 days off in 3 months' time. So for the rest of it, I've been scanning in every day and uploading and renaming the files and organizing them, et cetera, because that's the thing I do. It's not just scanning them in. I've got them all sorted and named as such. And, yeah, that's it. So let me stop boring you guys. Somebody probably has something much interesting to say. So.
What's the name of your YouTube channel?
Meet the Lone Gunman.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what, I will paste the link into Malcolm's video. It was just a fun chat, and I'm going to be talking mostly about O&I. And in the agency itself as well, the people working inside the agency. So during the HSCA, you had Robert Blakey talking to Scott Breckenridge, for instance. There was many documents on that. Of course, the internal documents. Russia, the embassy, Richard Snyder, loads on that. And so forth. So I could pick probably 50 items or names at least, and just say like, well, let's talk about this, and he'll fill in 20-30 minutes easily on that particular subject as such. So the idea is for me to do about 6 talks with him, and you know, time permitting, and also whether he's still here in the sense like still living in Britain, where I can get access to them, and whether I have the time to do so. and film him and just talk about stuff. So the pressure with the warehouse is just waning, because that was just a massive cross on my shoulders bearing me, because I had only that much time, and yet there were 20 cabinets with four drawer files in it. So, but thankfully that's almost done. So that's the good thing about it. And the I'll just post this in right now. Let's have a look. But if anyone has any other questions, then I'm more than happy to answer them. But yeah, that's my life basically for the next 9 months, and I really hope that I get my papers finished and start looking at something else. For now, the thing is, like, I couldn't make it more complete without the help of Malcolm's archive. There is stuff in there that a lot of people just absolutely don't have a clue about, and that's kind of interesting to know and to say, and say, yeah, you know what, this is really good. And from an informational informative point of view, you know, I didn't have to go to NARA for it and have to go through all the frustrating experience of going through it as such. And we'll see, but yeah, it's full on. And I am a bit tired, but other than that, yeah, I hope to finish this bit off rather sooner than later. So.
Well, good job, Mark.
Thank you.
Definitely keep us informed of what's going on and what you find. And it's always great to have you attend with us, too. I see that Joe sent me a message. He'd like to add something. Joe, go ahead. We don't have your microphone, Joe.
On mute.
No, he's unmuted. I just don't. We can't hear his voice.
Can't hear you, Joe.
Joe, go down to the mute section and hit the up arrow and make sure that your microphone says same as system. Or try one of your microphones and see which one will activate. You can do the test speaker microphone and see if it. If you can hear your voice come back through. Okay, well, while Joe's fixing on that, Bill, let me go ahead and unmute you there. there was a chat that came up here. Lisa Hardy, she's not able to actually use her microphone, but she's able to text. And in the chat, I don't know if you saw it or not, but she says she saw a talk by you on Captain Westbrook's and Reservist Croy. Does he still find them suspicious? Does he have anything to add to his research on these guys? His talk was abbreviated due to time constraints, so I was really wanting to hear the whole presentation. John Armstrong also had a lot to say about these two Dallas cops. Can he respond to those suspicions, and if anything has changed?
I can. Not much has changed. I was delighted to do the abbreviated version, because I actually thought it came out more clear. Try to limit my presentation to 20 minutes, TED Talk style. I think it's the most effective for me and everyone else. With that said, what we need on Westbrook, and I'm going to appeal to people in the community here, because the only person I know who has records of it is Jones Harris, and Jones won't share what he's got now or maybe ever. But there should be records out there in the military showing his background, and I think that they can be obtained. And the story goes that he and John Armstrong got this from Jones Harris, and it's in his book, that he was working as kind of a liaison between South Vietnamese police forces and the CIA. And so we're at a point now, I think, if we want to get more information from Westbrook, it's going to require some real spade work that I'm not equipped to do from where I sit. We need more Texas researchers, frankly. I really think that that is kind of the secret to all this. And while I've got the floor, I just wanted to add one brief thing about scanning. I wanted to salute you guys and in particular the Lone Gunman for all the scanning that's going on recently. There's Mary Farrell scanning tens of thousands of documents in Washington, D.C. as I speak. And it's in my mind, it's the single most important thing we can do right now. It's right up there with witness interviews before they die, because these documents don't last forever. And I couldn't help but notice, I put it in the chat, that NARA has released these big spreadsheets, and they say, for every document you want, they want four different pieces of information to be included in your request. You could be, that's like trying to dig all the sand off the beaches of North America. It's a complete waste of time. And I'm of the opinion that NARA, you know, who is sometimes our ally, is also sometimes our adversary. And right now I put them squarely in the adversarial box. I don't think there's really any alternative, but, to keep building a project to, scan all the documents in the Kennedy archives from NARA, because NARA's just never, they say they're going to do it, but you know what? I don't think they're ever going to do it. So that's a discussion for another day.
All right, Bill. Well, does anybody else have any questions for Bill? You know, like, he's on the floor now, so you can ask him. Good comment, Lisa, and I understand anything you put up there, I will definitely try to ask that for you if it doesn't get answered in the comment section. So let's see. Speaking of Bill, are you, I know you do your little, well, the last few times we've done like 15, 20 minute deals. Are you working on something for one of our next journey meetings that you'd like to, you know, give somebody a little something to salivate about?
Well, I could certainly say a few words about Bill Lowry. I don't think I really talked about Bill Lowry much. He was the other shoe store salesman in Oak Cliff, who also was the Communist Party representative for about 18 years. And he was also, about 2 months before the assassination, he turned around and became an FBI, outed himself as a 20-year-long FBI informant. In fact, most of the officers of the Communist Party in Dallas were FBI informants. A great way to pick up $200 a month from Joe Hosty, right? That was what he paid these guys. In fact, Lowry was brought to the House Committee on Assassinations and Wally Heitman, who was like the lead investigator on the Cubans in Dallas. He served as Bill's lawyer in front of the HSCA. And when Bill wanted to try to tell his story about what he knew about the Communist Party in Dallas, his lawyer made him shut up every time. Can you imagine? The guy who ran the Cuban ops for the FBI in Dallas was his lawyer. This guy was an absolutely fascinating guy. If people here are familiar with Herbert Philbrick, this guy was like the Herbert Philbrick of Dallas. Herbert Philbrick was best known as the guy who did the TV show I Led Three Lives as a Communist Party official and an agent for the FBI. And it's my thinking, and thinking of some other people, Greg Parker prominent among them, that in fact, not only did Lee Oswald want to be the Philbrick for Dallas, but you got to realize that Bill Lowry, this FBI CP fellow, tailed a number of guys and tracked them. And one of them was Joe Molina. Joe Molina worked at the Book Depository. He was their bookkeeper. And he was Hispanic. And Lowry had been tailing him for 8 years as a prominent activist and kept trying to get him to join the Communist Party. Never succeeded. Molina was the only other guy who was detained by the, I know people were questioned, but he was formally detained and had his home searched the night of November 22nd. And I think one question that we ought to be asking, I don't know if it's an answerable question, but I think it's an important question nonetheless, is was it in fact Oswald's job to take over Lowry's job? Not as head of the Communist Party necessarily, but as the guy who was tailing Joe Molina. Because, you know, for all you guys who are Prayer Man fans, Joe Molina's standing on the stairs when the motorcade's going by. And Lee Oswald may be the fella right behind him, standing behind him on the stairs, along with Buell Frazier and the rest. And to me, this makes more sense in terms of Oswald's movements that day than anything else, because Joe had a phone. He had an office, like on the second floor or so. And Joe was bouncing between the first and second floor and finally the stairs. And that's what Oswald was doing, too. I think Oswald was tailing Molina. It doesn't make sense to me why Oswald was bouncing back and forth between those stairs and not watching the motorcade when nobody was more interested in these politics than Oswald himself. Why is he the only person ostensibly not watching the motorcade? It's because he's doing something else. And the question's always been, what's that something else? I think this is actually, although it's, you know, speculative and theoretical, I think it might turn out to be one of the most fruitful lines of inquiry. And I've got a lot more on this, and I've got a lot more on Lowry. But that's my teaser for now.
Okay, Bill. Well, we'll be I'm very excited. I'm sure the audience is too, to see that come to one of our future meetings. And definitely want to throw this out to you. I would like to have a spotlight series event with you as well. So you can think about that in the back of your mind as soon as you want to do that. I have spots open, so I think we need to promote you and your work because you pick the topic that you want to talk about and, you know, figure out what day and time that we can do that at because I think you'd be a great fit for that. So.
Well, thank you. We'll talk about it offline, but before I forget, I'd like to do it in 20-minute bite-sized pieces with Q&A. And then back to the fray, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think if you did it like, you know, 20-minute increments, do some Q&As, then, you know, kind of like how Newman did where he broke it up into different chapters.
Oh, yeah. That's why I wanted to do it, too. I don't like to speak as long as John does. So that would work for me. We can do this offline, figure out the topic. If people have topics they want me to expound about, I can. With the understanding, my major focus is on Oswald and the double agent, Daring Do, and Mexico City and Tippett. Those are kind of the sweet spots for me.
Okay.
You can't cover everything. I'm fascinated by Germany and some other subjects, and I can maybe get a little of that in too. But what I find is bite-sized pieces are best, and I enjoy working on the pseudonym Cryptonym project because that way I can offer a lot of bite-sized information about Cuba to people that they wouldn't have otherwise in terms of the Cuban War and the whole backstory of what JFK walked into in 1961.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great thing, and it looks like it's already been in the comment section that Lisa Hardy, she said Mr. Simmers would be a great spotlight host, so I think definitely the I'm not the only one that thinks that. I think a lot of people enjoy the and I see in the comments they always enjoy the times that you know, take the floor and tell us about what you want to talk about. So,
well, thank you. I'm trying to focus on the new stuff because, you know, that's we need more new stuff all the time, and without forgetting the old.
All right. Well, I think I want to thank you again, Bill, for chiming in. And I think Joe's got his microphone fixed. So Joe, let's see what you got there.
Hello, can you hear me?
There we go. Yeah, we can hear
okay.
you.
Good. NARA put out 6 Excel databases, which are cataloging the RIF numbers. And I put out an Excel database previously on Linosanic's Black Op Radio show, show 1040. And that had about 330,000 plus RIF numbers in it. Now, a RIF number is a record identification form, which will give you, it's a 13-digit code, which will get you to a specific document in the JFK records collection. And when you go to NARA Archives 2 in College Park, if you do your homework, and you could do that when the JFK database was online that NARA had, and you could put in the 13-digit code, and you would see the RIF page. You wouldn't see the entire documents, but you would see the RIF page only. And you, that would have additional document. NARA wants you to at least have that RIF number, but that RIF page would also give you the agency number and some other information pertinent to a specific document. They since took that online database offline. It's still offline. It was taken off in September. And recently, on May 17th, NARA put up 6 Excel databases, which I think have all the RIF numbers in there that were in their online database or that they're trying to update. They haven't updated that database in forever. So I'm going through it, comparing it with my Excel database. But for now, that's a major improvement. It's much more than they previously had in the previous Excel database that they had. Somebody said that they think that 300,000 plus RIF numbers in the Excel database is not everything. That's true. I'm finding little numbers here and there that they skipped. If you just go through things numerically, you'll see that some numbers were skipped. So I'm quite busy going through all of that. But I do believe that the 330,000-odd number of RIF numbers that we have is the entire JFK records collection, and that will equate to the 5 or 6 million pages that we have. Now, everything that they've released is not, of course, online. I think way less than half of what was released by the JFK Act and the ARB and everything that's happened since the review board went away that they've released is available at Archives 2. At least I hope that's so. We went through some stuff where some things were reclassified when George Bush was president, but I think that's all been resolved. So, I mean, just because it was declassified does not mean it's online. So, for example, the Mary Farrell Foundation probably has well less than half of everything that's in Archives 2 is available on the Mary Farrell Foundation, but it's better than nothing. And you could save time and money, you know, if you do your homework. If it's on Mary Farrell, then it means you don't have to go to Archives 2 to get it. But I think a lot of it is still we have to get out of Archives 2 and make available and share and you know, give a scanned copy to Merrill Farrell so that everybody can have it. That's it.
I think that's good information there, Joe. You know, thanks to having the Merrill Farrell website and also, you know, us guys that are doing the scanning, and I know you scan stuff too, by having that, we seem to be able to make available some things that even, you know, NARA is not making available to us, especially things that are in people's private collections, like the Dick Russell collection we're working on now. So,
can I ask about that, the Dick Russell collection? Dick was a researcher for a long time and, of course, was getting documents that predate the JFK Act and the ARB, so that his documents would not have RIF numbers. So if you were scanning and putting up his documents, how are you identifying where that came from? Or you're just saying Dick Russell, or what are you doing?
Well, the way we've got it worked out in the when we receive the boxes from Baylor, they have gone through and basically put everything. The nice thing that they did that we didn't have to do, which I know Bart is now having to do, is they've categorized basically everything that was in his collection. I'm sure that Dick had a hand in that, but every folder has a specific title to it, and everything that's involved in that is in that folder. Now, as far as having it to where, you know, obviously if it's a newspaper article, it says what newspaper it's from. If it's a document that's in there, it's not just strictly documents. He had everything that he used to write his book with, but also what he had collected up to that time, putting his book together. You know, is it going to be a, it is going to, I'm working on making it a searchable, collection, right now, the key part of it is I'm actually scan every document into it, but as I'm scanning, they become searchable, documents, a total searchable collection, and then it's going to be, I know that we're looking at actually releasing things as searchable PDFs. I know Baylor's looking at them as individual images, and that's fine, but that means it's kind of like going back to, like, the Weisberg collection, where everything's in a folder, and you have to have the entire folder. Well, hell, there may be 200-300 documents in that folder, and you got to search through it. So what it is, because the only thing you're going to have is an image, and it's going to say image and number, or like box one, file one, image one. Well, That I think by making it more of a searchable PDF, it'll be a whole lot easier to find what you're looking for.
David, I got a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I wanted to ask Joe, those documents from the spreadsheet he posted, I've been carrying on about it a little bit on chat. I got the impression that those are just the RIF numbers, and they're not the actual documents.
The XFL database basically has what you would have if you could see the RIF sheet itself. And that also has a little more information, but it's basically...
It's got metadata. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's great. That's great. It's an important resource, and I have seen it. And I wanted to ask you if you heard any word whether they are actually doing any scanning of any documents besides the new ones. Because they promised years ago that they were going to do it. And Rex is so fed up over at Mary Farrell that we're talking about a possible project where we just try to scan the rest of the documents at Mary.
Very surprised when they offered us the scanned PDFs in 2017 and 2018. That was good.
I think it's good they did it because it was just easier to do it than deal with the thousands of requests.
Well, I think they did it because it was a way of dealing with all the intelligence agencies that they would have to deal with, would have equities in that and would bitch and moan, oh, we want to keep that secret and whatnot.
Right.
So they probably already had to scan it. And here's all these intelligence agencies that we have to deal with. Okay. So we're going to, you haven't given us, you know, you haven't filled in the paperwork to keep this secret yet. So we're, here we go. And we release it. When they released it in July, I think that the first time in 2017 when they did it, that scared them. I think.
That's like a shot over the bow.
Yeah, and so they started, you know, oh, we better fill on the paperwork if we want to keep stuff secret. So I think that motivated them to try to, you know, go to the president and keep some stuff secret. But in 2017 and 2018.
Now they won't even tell us what they're asking to keep secret.
yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Now this is a great moment in time. I think it's going to be an exciting few months ahead.
Well, hopefully.
Bottom line is everybody needs to start scanning. Simple as that. Quit cracking, start scanning. Simple as that. There's no reason. Stay off Facebook, quit cracking, and start scanning. Simple motto and mantra that everybody should do. I'm not kidding.
No. If I had a glass, I would raise it.
Every person that helps lightens the load. If you know of someone who's got files and so forth, then just say, look, scan this stuff in. You know, You know, stop cracking. Get on with it. Well, you know, the single bullet theory, you know.
I know when I was at Kappa back in 2018, I think it was 2018, I spoke at Kappa, and that's when I brought this out, that what Project JFK was going to be doing next, which was starting to create an online database and scanning silos of, you know, basically I consider everybody's collection like different silos of information. And I had a PowerPoint to help explain it better, because I remember meeting with Casey and Brian at a pizza parlor in town. I said, guys, I started taking salt and pepper shakers and moving shit around on the table. I said, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, they after I showed that, then they go, oh, that's a great idea. It was getting the different silos. And I said, I don't care if it's one piece of paper. I don't care if it's 1,000, 100,000 pieces of paper. Everybody that's in the research community, or that have been, you know, researchers in the past, maybe they kind of fell out of it, but they still have documents, whether it's, you know, paper, whether it's video files, audio files, interviews, whatever it could possibly be. I said, there has to be a place for that. Not everybody has a website, you know, whether they, you know, just choose not to do it or don't have the know-how to do it or the expense and the funds to do it. I said, we've got a website. We've got a vehicle. Let's start filling that vehicle with information.
Yeah.
And once I showed that to, or once I presented that at Kappa, that's when Dick Russell came up and spoke with Brian about, you know, my stuff's been set in Baylor for 10 years and people have to make a trip down there and to request to see the things. We're making it available online for people to, you know, to see. Well, it took, you know, about a year before we actually had the hard copies in our hands, and we've been working feverishly trying to get it, you know, completed. And that's only one.
It's really simple. Smartphone, get your Adobe scan on it. You can have a free copy. Yeah, so that doesn't cost you. If it does, it's $10 a month. Okay, so that doesn't break the bank. And then the second thing is start getting a Gmail. Get a Gmail address. When you have a Gmail address, you get 15 gigs of storage. There's a Google Drive in there, but you have 15 gigs. Obviously, you share that with your emails, but if you make some funny, stupid emails to yourself, then you have 15 gigs of online storage.
Right.
Now, I pay, I don't know, something like $30 per year, or 40 maybe, on having 100 gigs because 15 gigs wasn't enough because I'm already 80% filled up. But that's how simple it is. It's nothing that breaks the bank basically. If you spend $100 a year on the whole thing, maybe 150 tops, you have a massive storage place and a really simple way of recording this stuff and just upping it and sharing the links because that also is like a walk in the park. It is absolutely piss easy to do that as such. So,
and is it easy to search?
Sorry?
Yeah, is it easy to search when the documents that you have obtained off your phone?
Well, yes and no. No, because yes, if you can take text or a proper name from something and put it in Mary Farrell, because often Malcolm, I mean, we love him, but he would not copy. He would not copy the riff page. Son of a bitch.
Malcolm told me about this. He said, it's really simple.
Malcolm
he said, why should I scan in 300 pages when the real information is on a dozen of them? And then he said, I'm not scanning it in. Because he was reading it while he was basically things to copy as such. It would slow him down to such an extent that he just went, no, these 12 pages. But it's not with every document because some documents are incomplete because they just are at NARA.
Yes,
it's a mixture
right.
of things, basically.
Yes, but if they were complete to begin with, sometimes Malcolm didn't copy the whole complete thing. And,
yeah.
I mean, I don't... Malcolm probably never intended when he started that his stuff would wind up being scanned by Bart and then put available for the world to see. So, and back then it cost you money and he was trying to save money and such, but I just wish if he could have written down in the back of the blank side of the paper where the hell you got stuff from. And now that's not true with everything. I mean, it's, you know, six of one, six of another, he would copy the riff page. And when he does copy the riff page, some of it is great. A lot of the stuff he found and when he copied, a document has a certain lifestyle when it's being declassified. Sometimes more as you go forward in time, there's less black ink and less redacted stuff on it. So it's interesting to see back and forth what copy he, Malcolm, got of a document, and maybe Malcolm got the document before guys came in and redacted information from it. So sometimes he'll have a document where he can read everything. Whereas if you go to the same document on Maris Farrell, the black ink is still on there. So it's interesting to get a Malcolm Blunt copy of a document as well, especially if it has a riff number.
Yeah. So it's only because he basically went to the archives over a period of 20-odd years.
Years, yeah.
This is Bob from New York. Just on a technical note, some suggestions that were being made. I use a piece of software some of you may already own or be familiar with called ViewScan, V-U-E-S-C-A-N. And it is a remarkably powerful piece of software with respect to scanning, automating scanning, even making more obsolete scanning devices work better before you consider not using them anymore. So it's from a company called I have no interest in this, by the way, other than just being a subscriber, but it's a one-time license fee. So it's from Hamrick, Hamrick.com, called ViewScan.
I mean, I've used it 8 years ago, but it's for a flatbed scanner. What I need is a document feed scanner, because the thing is, flatbed scanning is useless when it comes to when you have thousands of pages in front of you. You will go to the shed with a length of rope because of the frustration you have to deal with.
Understood, Bart, but the company recognized that, and they now have an ADF version of it. So
right.
You can get one that controls your document feeder, and it's good at adapting to what you want to do. And what I found it extremely useful for is, documents and other things like films and slides and so forth that have degraded because of the time factor are remarkably recoverable. I've been working on some 13 by 17 millimeter little tiny color negatives that Gary Shaw has sent to me, and I have had unbelievable success in recovering these highly faded images. So just, again, something that may help automate. If not, whatever. I use it on a Canon flatbed.
Well, another thing, Bart, I want to throw this in there. With having Gmail, then you automatically get 15 gigs of online storage. But anybody that actually pays for Microsoft Office, not the free one that you get, you know, for on Microsoft Online, but if you actually pay for Microsoft Office 365, you get a terabyte of OneDrive storage. And a lot of people forget about that, but, you know, instead of having to, run out and grab little, flash drives, you've got a terabyte of storage that you can put your stuff in the cloud, and you can always download from the cloud back onto a, portable device later on. But, like I say, 1 terabyte, that's, if you were to go out and buy
But this
it,
is the, it's all right? secondary. The main issue when NARA opens up again, and we need to get people in there, and they need to be familiar with what a RIF number is in order to get the documents in the first place. So familiarize yourself with the Excel databases that NARA has put out. It'll give you the RIF number, and often you'll also need the agency number, because the documents were kept together by the agency of origin. So if you have a RIF number and an agency number, that's the best, especially when you're DBI records. Usually a RIF number alone will get you some information. When anybody goes into Archives 2, when they open up again, and you go as an individual, or you go with a friend or a group of friends, and if you bring in your own equipment, whether it's a handheld iPhone, whether it's a digital camera, whether it's a flatbed scanner, you can copy things and they won't charge you. If you use their equipment, they're going to charge you, I don't know, 25 cents, 50 cents more a page now. But if you bring in your own equipment, you can scan for hours all day long and they're not going to charge you. That's the way to do it. But if we go in, for the love of God, copy the list page. For Jesus Christ's sake, don't find page 72 is interesting to you and put that on a knife and stick it and put it over here in a big pile. Because 18 years later, somebody named Joe Backus Jr. is going to try to figure out where the fuck this came from. And he won't know. Copy the riff page.
You know, if there's no riff involved, Joe Backus thinks he's in hell. I'm not kidding. If there's no riff involved, my God, there's no riff.
So good.
We're lost. We're lost if you don't copy the riff page. We're just lost.
Right. Well, I know that, I explained to Brian when we first, you know, started, you know, when we were talking about doing it, he goes, well, what are we going to scan? I said, we're scanning everything. If it's in a folder, everything gets scanned. Front, back, I don't give a shit. We're going to scan it. The only thing that we don't scan is if, you know, like Dick was always great about putting an X through something that, you know, that wasn't part of the article that was in like a magazine tear out that he had or something. I said, yeah, that obviously isn't part of, you know, what that file is. I said, but other than that, I said, yeah, we scan everything. And
if you go into archives too, especially in the early days, and it's still true today with some things, if you go in there, in addition to the paperwork, you'll sometimes find some artifacts. And when in the early 90s, they would bring stuff over by the truckload, and they didn't have the people to process stuff. They didn't hire archivists and whatnot and professionals who passed the clearances and the federal civil service things and the archive training. So in with the file folder, you would find photographs. You would find films. Okay. After a while, those were removed and put into a different floor of archives too. You would find audio cassettes. You could find all kinds of things. I found Oswald's polygraph test results and paraffin stuff and other things in there. And you could find stuff. But if you do find anything that is not textual, that's not a document, take it over there and photocopy it anyway, because that'll be proof. I found on this – and document what you did. Take notes of what you're doing. I found on this day there was a researcher, Anne-Marie Kunz-Walko, found the Secret Service copy of the Zapruder film in a file folder in a little can. And so you need to keep track of things that you're finding, because if you go back there, you know, 5 months later, it's not going to be in that folder.
Whatever happened to Oswald's polygraph? Do you have that still?
I think so, yeah.
Could you post that somewhere, Joe? That would just be a real find.
If
there's no Oswald.
If I remember, huh? If I remember,
there's no Oswald.
It's some graph. It's some graph I have. I'll have to recheck that.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Hey, Joe, is it the polygraph of Jack Ruby? About 33 pages, but they don't give you any explanation. No.
And Frazier's so-called polygraph.
Yeah, we'd like to find that one, too.
I've got a folder. I think I made a blog post about this about 3 years ago, and I've got documents from the feds and ACCA, and they're all asking about it, this, that, and the other, and the BPD says that they send it to the FBI, and the FBI said we never got it, and blah, 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 and the whole thing is going into circles, basically, and I've got about 20 to 30 pages on all this hubbub, and you're not getting any further whatsoever.
Hey, Joe, do you know if there was any evidence that any of the bullets that were fired at the proving grounds were ever kept? Because they have like 40 or 50 rounds that were fired, at least. No.
I could be, I don't know. They had some of them that wet like this slug go in a slide. when they say, you know, the single bullet was fine and did everything, and the Edgewood Arsenal proving grounds where they fired bullets that just went into a wrist and it's all deformed, and it just went into a goat cadaver and it's all deformed. There's like five or six bullets, and none of them are as pristine as the.
No, but I'm talking about the holes. When, you know, they tested the rifle for a variety of reasons. One was to see what the single bullet theory was working, was possible, what the bullet would look like, but also in terms of speed and accuracy. So they had like 50 rounds that they fired, and just wondering if they threw away those holes or whether you saw any reference that those holes were kept.
I haven't memorized every possible artifact, but I mean, I have no idea. To answer your question, I have no idea.
Okay.
Larry, what you need to understand is that the actual access to physical evidence at NARA
is
practically impossible, okay? So it used to be quite easy to get the 357 and have a look at it. Malcolm had the Minix camera in his hand, and it was glued shut, right? So you couldn't look inside. And all these type of funny things. But he says, like, nowadays, you got to have a really good reason, and it has to be, you know, submitted beforehand before you finally get a chance, a yes or no answer, you know, with regard to accessing the physical material as such. That's nowadays. So it's best to know someone who works there or who has influence there. That's
the reason. The reason to look at that was to see if the tool marks actually changed as they fired the rifle, because when they tried to fire the rifle in 78, they claimed that the rifle had changed because of time and that they could not match up the bullets fired then to the 1963 bullets. So, you know, but I assume that like everything else, they just threw away those shells. But
yeah, you would think instead of just holding on to the bullet itself, to actually hold on to the cartridge cases in order to find out where the primer marking is, if it's still – see, a primer marking and a cartridge case, just like the bullet, they're like fingerprints in forensics. They match up. Now, unless they're going to go in and fire, you know, 1,000-plus rounds – rifling that's going to be in a weapon, it's not going to degrade, you know, after shooting 40, 50 rounds through it. I mean, anytime that they would say they can't match it because, you know, the marking, and it's not really a tool mark, it's the rifling of it coming out of the gun from being fired. If they're saying that was done in less than, you know, 40, 50 rounds, well, that's bullshit. It's not going to change that much. Just like they can go back and look at the primer on the cartridge that's been fired and see exactly where does that match up at? You know, how far off center or where does it hit on that primer?
It's well, like David, let's put together a challenge to the NARA. Let's put in a request for you and other experts to physically examine the rifle and the bullet and get the work done and challenge NARA. This stuff belongs to the American people. It doesn't belong to them.
Right.
And I want to see the inside of the 357 where people were supposed to put their initials in. Now, Bentley's initials apparently are on it. I saw a pretty good reproduction of that, but that was only like a couple of years ago. But I don't see any other initials in that gun. And some of them said during the testimony that it was inside of the grip that they put that. And yet not one of these damn pictures that are online or this I've seen in collections so far has a picture of the inside of the grip as such. So I'd just like to see that.
Cliff Spiegelman had testified at our mock trial about how machine guns don't change if it fires thousands of rounds. So that's consistent with what David said. And the idea is that, you know, we have the FBI or at the HSCA, people paid by the government to look at the four holes and say, yes, they were consistent with the rifle. But we have 40 other, 50 other bullets out there that presumably we could all map to see if you know, they used four bullets that yes, these were consistent with the rifle, because the testimony wouldn't match today's standards, even if it was
consistent. Consistent is a weasel word anyway.
Yes. Now they have to.
I think if they don't have that stuff in the archive, they'll probably give the same bullshit excuse. Well, we just ran out of room. You know, we couldn't have just a bag full of shells that would probably fit in a sandwich bag. You know, that was too much room we needed to have for, you know, other stuff. So, you know, if you go out and do a test, I mean, even police departments, they go out and they do tests with weapons that come in. They'll take it to a tank. They'll shoot it and see if they can match it up. They keep everything in evidence bags, in evidence boxes, for trial. And then after that's done, those evidence boxes are sealed. They get put into a warehouse. Nowhere should be the exact same way. Anything that was used, we should be able to go back 58 years later, 60 years later, and look at that information and go, you know what? The spent cartridge cases that they found on the sixth floor that day, those match up to when they test fired that rifle on the range. And if we don't have that, they need to answer why the hell they don't have it in their archives.
Well, the thing is, what you see now, you're coming into Malcolm Blunt land. That territory basically just goes, where you get letters and they said basically like, well, we have a process in our paperwork that says we keep it for 25 years and then we destroy it.
Right.
Doesn't matter what the subject is, stands for, they just destroy it as such. And of course, you know, how are you going to attack that? You know, unless there is like some kind of a law or whatever, at some point say, well, because it's this, you need to basically send it over to the National Archive as such. And that's the same story with the Secret Service files, who actually destroyed the files while they were actually requested from the ARB, but because the ARB didn't have any power as such, boom, that's that. So that's the issue.
Yeah, we are getting that same, go around from university libraries that are saying, well, we have to get rid of these files here. Because we don't have enough room for what? You know, I mean, it's a warehouse, it's a storage house, you know, for documents. And I'm going, so you're going to do what with them? Well, we're going to shred them. We don't need them anymore. Holy cow. That's some of the runaround we've been getting from universities saying, well, you know, these researchers who have passed on gave us all their documents, and nobody's checked them out. Well, hell, does anybody know that they're actually there? Okay, so, and that's why we're, you know, we're doing what we're doing. And we know.
Yeah, I think it's really good that you did that with Baylor and all that. That's really good. But it's actually, it should be in all these so-called archives that are in many different states. They basically need to be gone through. And are you guys keeping this? Are you getting destroyed? Okay, if you want to get rid of it, can we be the point of point B where it can go to and so forth? You know, that would help.
Yeah,
it's happening in all levels of government. I mean, even, you know, when I do FOIA requests for environmental documents, the states are just starting to destroy things because, you know, they just running out of room and they just destroy things. And it, I mean, this is all supposed to be documents that are preserved, but, you know.
Larry, to address real quick your comment about the rifling and the rifling inside the barrel of the carcass, whatever rifle they found in the revolver that they supposedly took off of Oswald. The only thing that will alter the inside of a barrel is two things. One is you fire thousands of rounds through that barrel without cleaning it. It's going to leave soot. It's going to leave lead particles. It's going to leave copper particles. And it's not going to change the rifling. It's just going to make it harder to identify it from a known source. In other words, if you fire, you have the three rifle shells from the Carcano that were ejected. They're going to leave ejector marks. They're going to leave primer marks. Those you can examine without having to change the configuration of the rifling inside the barrel. The bullets themselves, the spent rounds, are then can be compared to the rifling in the barrel. But if it's never been cleaned, or if it's been fired 1,000 times or 50 times, it's going to leave some deposits. It's going to make it a little bit more difficult. But the story that you presented was that it was fired in 63 at the Aberdeen training or proving grounds, and then it wasn't fired again until 67. Then there should be no question that that rifle, that barrel should be as clean as it was when they put it away in 63.
Now they said it was also was poorly kept. If it got rusty.
It got rusty on its own?
Yeah, they said if you look at the testimony, 78, it looks like they were claiming that the condition of the rifle deteriorated, and that's why they cannot match the rifling.
Well, it's corroded probably because they left oil inside it. They didn't clean it or put a swab down it to keep it preserved. And who knows what they did to it. The other way to alter the rifling of a firearm is to stick a mechanical device in it, like an ice pick a pick or a scribe or a diamond pointed tip blade of some kind, and in there and scratch it. But no self-respecting police officer that I've ever dealt with or ever trained, we never told anybody when you go to a crime scene and you find a firearm to scratch your initials on the inside of the barrel. First of all, that's impossible. Second of all, you're going to alter the rifling of that barrel. So that's why you put a tag on it. You don't alter the weapon in any way. You don't take the grips off and scribe your name in it like Bentley did. He's just an idiot. Apparently nobody told him not to do that, but if that's what he did, then he altered the weapon. It's not the actual weapon that they found, because it wasn't like that when they found it at the scene. So you put a tag on it. You don't put any marks anywhere on the exterior or the interior of the rifle or the gun or whatever you have, so that to preserve it in its pristine fashion as you found it. So if they've altered that inside of the rifling of that rifle or that gun or that pistol, then there's not too many technical people that can. I'm sure there's somebody in, you know, CSI TV can probably go through there and see what the original groove lands and grooves look like, but for what we know in forensics, as far as what's available now, I think what they're going to be able to do is simply go in and visually look and see if there's any residue in there, run a swab down it, which Fritz and his moron crew didn't do, to find out if there's any gun grease or if there's any oil or lubricant of any kind in there. That would have been very simple to do. Saying, yeah, this rifle's been recently fired. At least it hasn't been cleaned since it was last fired. So
wasn't the way to do that as well by pouring water through the barrel? That it had been recently fired?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear all that part. What did you say?
Look, would they not pour water through the barrel to see whether it had been recently fired?
No, that wouldn't tell you anything. Because all the lead residue would be gone. The best thing they could have done, and the cheapest thing they could have done, is simply visually look through it. You could see whether the rifling has been is altered. Put a light at the end of it, a bore light, or stick a clean sterile swab through it. That's going to tell you if there's any gun residue, if there's any lead residue, or any kind of residue, and then microscopically look at that and see if it matches the rifling of that gun. But,
so, Brian, two questions. One is, so there's been a dispute when we talk about Forrest Lucy saying the rifle was dirty, allegedly saying the rifle was dirty, and then people saying, well, that doesn't matter because the firing of the bullet it could still be dirty even after the bullet's fired.
Right.
It wouldn't clean out the rifle. Okay. Second thing is, this guy that's the trial attorney also claims to be an expert on rifles, and he said it's wrong to say that the target would have been moving away from the sixth floor gunman, because the only thing that would be happening when he's looking through the scope is that the target is getting smaller, not moving away from him. That seems like a trope to me, but I'm just curious what your reaction is.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the best if a shooter was positioned in the Oswald window or the sniper's window, that obviously, when the car's coming to you and it's getting bigger, you don't even need a scope.
Right.
But as the target moves away from you, obviously it's going to get smaller, and your field of fire is going to be a lot more limited as far as angle, and side to side movement. I mean, that, remember that bullet's only 1/6 of an inch wide. And if a person is in a seated position and he moves like this far, and that your target, you don't expect the target to move, then you're going to have a miss. But, yeah, that.
But his argument was that he didn't have to, in other words, people were saying, well, the target's moving away, so he has to keep moving the rifle or the scope to match where the car's going. He's saying, no, he didn't have to move, putting aside for the fact that when you fire it, you're going to have to resight it. But he was just arguing that all that's happening is the target in the scope is getting smaller, but right, it's not moving, but the car was moving.
Right.
To the left.
And remember, there's two types of ambush with the rifle. You can do the ambush method, which you just point the rifle at a spot, and you know if the target goes to that, then you put your scope on where the target's going to be. The second way is the swing method. It's like hunters, you know, or skeet shooters. They will track the object with their gun. They'll track it with the target. And in this case, you know, who knows what kind of methods they use, but either way, if any shooters were behind the target, they're obviously going to be smaller in the scope as the car goes closer to the overpass. I mean,
and the argument then is that it does, there's still a greater difficulty because whether you're moving with the target or staying still, it's getting smaller.
Right.
So the fact that you fire at one point, the next shot becomes harder, regardless of whether it's because you're tracking it or because it's getting smaller.
Exactly. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, another thing I want to throw in this, to go back to the lands and grooves of the spent rounds that were test fired after the events of November 22nd. Okay, just a couple years ago, they went in and digitally scanned, 3D scanned the rounds that are in the archives. Now, did they scan every one? No, they didn't scan every one of them. They only scanned, like, basically, I think it was the top four. I think they came up with four scans. I know I've showed it before on one of our shows, one of our meetings. But
they did the three that was found on the sixth floor.
Right. Now, here's the thing. They can scan, they can digitize and make a 3D scan of the actual rounds that were fired. They can also, they could digitize and scan the shell casings, and they could also digitally scan the inside of that barrel to match up the lands and grooves. Now, have they digitized the inside of that barrel? Hell no, they haven't done that. Have they digitized the other cartridges? No, they haven't done that either.
And that's what Cliff Spiegelman was going to do before he unfortunately died. He was going to get his university to go to, and because he was going to use the auspices of Austin, the university at Austin, to go to NARA and request the ability to do that. And he's a statistician, so he was going to be able to use his analysis, but now we've lost him. We've also lost that university because of that, and we don't have anyone now that has the same kind of university kind of gravitas behind him to do this. And I'm just, you know, it was a tremendous loss on both a personal and both research community level. And I just don't know if we have someone that could make, you know, be able to, we might have to sue them, you know, to have access, but someone that has that kind of gravitas that could overwhelm or overcome the resistance to having these artifacts examined by a third party.
Yeah, I think what the NIST did, and for those that don't know what the NIST is, it's the National Institute of Standards and Technology. For what they did for the scans, for them to be able to scan the rest of what's in the archives and what should still be in the archives, even though we don't know whether the shell casings are there or the other bullets that they recovered from doing the test firing, they should surely be able to use their machines to scan in the inside of that barrel to look at the parts of the lands and
grooves. So the ask should be, I guess the next step is to ask the NIST to scan the interior of the bullet and any remaining documents. And if they refuse to do that, then the question is, you know, Bill and I will have to, you know, kind of noodle on this as to whether there's a legal remedy to do that. But that, I guess that's the next step with the absence of the cliffs now. And he was actually pleased, I think, with the work that NSIT did. You know, what we, the next step was to basically have a computer now analyze the 3D image against something, and we don't have that something, right? Because we don't have the inside of the rifle.
Right, and I'm reading here, it says scientists also photographed two bullets discharged as test shots by FBI firearms experts during the case investigation, and the stretcher bullets. So I know just from what they have released, now here, if we kind of go back to this, okay, I've seen the fragments, I've seen CE-399, but they're saying that they also scanned in two bullets that the FBI team, you know, had test fired. They only shot it twice. That's all that they scanned. No, they shot it more than that. So
right.
They're picking and here's the thing that pisses me off. They're picking and choosing what they're going to scan. It kind of goes back to what I said a while ago. If you're going to scan something in a collection, you scan the whole damn collection. Because that way you've got, somebody can't come and say, well, okay, you only have these four pages out of 45 pages in that document. It's the same idea. The NISP, they were tasked by NARA to do the scans, and they need to scan everything that's in the archives that can source to that weapon, those bullets, and also any other weapon that, you know, that they have, you know, like the 357. Let's have the scans of that done as well. And I know it takes time, and I know it takes money, and I know it takes, you know, effort as far as manpower to do this. But if they're not going to let us go down there and physically see it, and I don't think some people probably should have it in their hands to physically see it, because they don't know what the hell they're looking for in the first place, and we don't want more damage to happen to something because they've already stated, well, you know, this could be damaged by somebody hailing it. And I agree with, you know, if somebody goes down there and they don't know what the hell they're doing, and maybe they do happen to make, you know, a mark, whether it's an engraving of some sort, you know, on that weapon, then that destroys the evidence. That destroys what we have in the archives.
So maybe
get the NISC to actually, you know, scan the rest of what's in there, not just
right.
You don't cherry pick it. You take the entire thing.
Right. Now it may be that answers the question I asked first. That maybe that's all that's left in the in the archives. But Brian, is there a law enforcement organization that could be trusted to make this request and do it right? I'm just trying to think of having some reputable organization that we could have asked to have this done, that would allow NARA to, you know, they would be inclined to let this organization, obviously if NIST did it, if the best thing to do would be have them do it again, but if they don't have the resources to do it, then, you know, an outside lab. Brian?
That's reasonable. iTech, because they got the means and they also have the knowledge to do things like that. Anything on photography, 3D, all that stuff.
Would we trust iTech?
Hey, I don't trust anyone, so there you go.
Okay, look at Brian.
I don't trust anyone.
Well, I think Brian stepped away just for a second, but Larry, I'm going to pass that question to him because I think that's the question. About 10 years ago, Brian and I were discussing the ballistics of the remaining hulls that were brought in by the Dallas police from the supposed 38 revolver that was used to kill Officer Tippett. And we were looking at those ballistics, and after about 2 days, I said, I don't know that much about this, and David, you might want to jump in on this a little bit, but we looked at the bottom of the hull itself, which had an imprint. The imprint was from, I believe, the trigger, which had a little note on it, and that trigger is the one that would hitting that would ignite the gunpowder, which would fire off the bullet. And what we noticed was in those four holes, three of them had the same round node in the back of that hole. And then the fourth one, it was off to the right. And I looked at that and I'm sitting there going, are these fired from the same, or chambered and fired from the same gun?
But what you're talking about, Casey, is you're talking about the firing pin attached to the hammer that will strike the primer.
Right.
That's what Casey's talking about. And that's what I'm saying, you know, that's, depending on where it's located at, you can match up, you could basically take you could take another cartridge, load it into that gun, shoot it, in a test fire, and then you pull out that cartridge or you pick up that cartridge, whether it's an automatic, whether it's revolver, or semi-automatic, whether it's revolver, compare those two casings and look at where the firing pin strikes that primer, and you can match it up and see, does it match? Does it look like it's been fired from the same, from the same weapon? So.
And I think one of the reasons I brought that up is because when the FBI was trying to match all four of those holes, they said, well, they all match. And I'm sitting there going, no, they don't. I said, to a layman who's looking at this and doesn't know anything about ballistics, I'm seeing three of them match up and the fourth one doesn't. But David, you're saying that they could match up?
No, what I'm saying of is if you've got three that match up perfectly fine on the firing from the firing pin to the primer, and you've got one that doesn't match the same spot on that same position of that primer, the likelihood of that coming from that weapon is less likely. If you've got three that are perfect, the indentation is perfect from the firing pin to that primer.
Right, correct.
You have one that is off, way off to the side. The likelihood that it came from that firearm, especially if they fire them in succession order, one right after another, it's not going to match. It's not going to.
David, let me. The HSCA report, footnote 8 on page 50, about going back to the rifle.
Uh-huh.
It says the committee firearms panel determined that the evidence stored in the National Archives ballistically matched the bullets fired by the FBI. In 1964 tests from the Manitowocano found by Boone. Since the rifle had been tested numerous times since 1963, its barrel had been altered by wear, and bullets the panel fired from the rifle did not match either the FBI test cartridges or those found in the sixth floor depository or that found on the stretcher.
Was that the House Senate Select Committee?
Yep. Footnote 8.
Yeah, to me, what that tells me, and I know I've went to the range several times, and I've fired I fired one of my weapons that was dirty, because I went back and I remember hearing something about that, and this was probably 5 or 10 years ago that was brought to my attention. So I went to the range and I fired my 9mm, one that had been, I took it and went ahead and fired it dirty. I used it. Went back, ran another round through it, and, I'm talking 50 to 100 rounds, and depending on, again, it also kind of comes back to your ammunition. There's things known as dirty ammunition. One that is, like, if you shoot, say you shoot like a 22, let's just say a 22, for instance. Some 22s are lead-tipped, some are a full metal jacket. Okay, a lead-tipped round is always going to make the barrel more dirty with lead deposits than what is going to be out of a full metal jacket. Well, if we remember, we look at the Carcano round. The Carcano rounds were full metal jacket rounds. They weren't just open lead tip bullet. Is it going to dirty the gun as you fire more rounds through it? Of course it's going to. But I just don't see how, unless they fire thousands of rounds through it, if they only fired, anywhere between 50 to 100 rounds, or hell, less than 200 rounds, I don't see how it could be that dirty. I mean, obviously, anything's possible with it, but how do they come out and say that it did not match the stretcher bullet, or it didn't match the rounds that they found in 63? I mean, I don't know, Brian, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, the only thing I can talk about is from personal experience, and I've probably fired 20,000 rounds in my career. That's why you always clean the barrel after you shoot it, so that it doesn't, you know, alter your flight path. I mean, the more lead and more crap you have in there, it's going to make the bullet wobble more. Sometimes shooting a dirty rifle is better because you know what the characteristics might be, and you know if it has to be, you know, your sight has to be led a little bit further because you have a crappy, shitty gun that's not been cleaned for a long time. But
that was an extraordinary statement, though, that their firing did not match.
Right.
And their
excuse for having a dirty rifle is not, doesn't hold water.
It was actually, they didn't mention it was dirty. They said it was fired numerous times.
Yeah.
I have to look at the actual forensic report to see. I thought I remembered seeing something about rust, but do we have anyone that we could, is anyone in our community that, I'm thinking maybe Tobin or somebody that is that kind of expert that could refute that?
Well, the only way that there would be rust in there is if it was left out in an environment that's moist for a long period of time. But if the rifle was kept in a climate-controlled environment in a box,
with no humidity or anything,
how would rust get inside the barrel? How do you do that? I don't know how you do that. I have a firearm that I've had since the 70s. I haven't fired it since the 70s. It's sitting in my basement next to my desk, and it's perfectly capable of firing a shotgun shell, and there's no rust in it because it's not been subjected to any moisture or water pouring down the barrel or anything like that. No, I don't see how a rifle could get rusted by just sitting in a box somewhere. So unless they threw it in the lake, for a while and then brought it out and then didn't dry it. Yeah, you're going to have rust and moisture in there. But as far as firing three rounds and then next it's fired and 2 months, 3 months later, and you fire 50 rounds, and then the next time it's fired is in 76, and something happened. If there's rust in there, something happened between the last time they fired it and the next time they fired it. So, you know, it's in the hands of the federal government, so you make that call, Larry. I don't know how they'd explain that. You know, if you go to court and go, well, I see that there's rust in this barrel now. Can you tell me who had this rifle and where it was kept? Yeah, we kept it in a lake for preservation purposes or some shit like that, you know. No, you put it in a climate-controlled environment that nobody can get to it. It's dry. Maybe, you know, here's another thought. Maybe they cleaned it with water and, solvent and stuff and then never dried it and left it to sit in a locker for 30 years or 20 years. Yeah, you could get some rust particles growing in that. But as far as just normal firing, putting it in a box in a climate-controlled environment, there's no rust. There shouldn't be any rust in that rifle.
And if they want to put it to rest, what the inside of that barrel actually looks like, then scan the son of a bitch so we can see it with our own eyes. You know, let somebody, you know, a third party actually put a bore scope, you know, bore light down there and a bore scope and see exactly what the condition of that barrel is. I mean,
we don't have that. I mean, most rifle barrels will have, or most firearm barrels will have a specific twist and groove, pattern, mm-hmm. 2 degrees right-hand twist or 1 degree left-hand twist. That's never going to change unless you alter that with an external force, like a scribe or a barrel just putting a brass, clean, rod down there could alter. It could scratch the barrel, but it's not going to affect the lands and grooves and the twists of that barrel. We've never seen pictures of the inside of that barrel. I don't know.
So I'm looking at, I think David and Brian, you may want to look at volume 7 of the HSCA. That's where the firearms panel have their report, because there's stuff in here they claim they did a microscopical examination. I think you got, but maybe it'd be beneficial for you guys with your backgrounds.
Are there pictures of it, Larry?
I don't know. Let me see. I'm just going through it now.
You're talking volume 7 of the HSCA report, right?
Yeah, volume 7, yeah.
Okay.
I'd be interested to see if there are any photographs of that barrel, the inside of that barrel.
Yeah, I don't know. But that's something I think, because that's such a powerful statement they made. They just completely dismissed.
Yeah.
And if that's not, you know.
In fact, if the rust is so minute, it's so minuscule in places, you fire a couple hard, you know, fire a couple full metal jacketed bullets through it, that'll probably clean out a lot of that rust.
Yep.
It's going to deposit some more copper and lead or whatever antimony that might be. But the rust eventually will burn away, you know, if it's small enough. I mean, it's not, if the rust is completely encased in that barrel and a bullet won't go through it, you're not going to be able to fire it. But I still can't get my head wrapped around how a rifle barrel would get rusty unless it was introduced to some moisture or water or something that would cause that.
Hey, David, this is Bob from New York. Could I share something with the group?
Hold
on a second here. Let me know when you see an image.
Okay, well, it shows that you started your screen share. I don't have an image just yet. But
now, while he's doing that, it says the panel attributed the changes in the bore caused by repeated firing. This is on page 370 of volume 7. Of firings of the rifle by the FBI and the Infantry Weapons Evaluation Branch of the U.S. Army to test its accuracy, as well as to deterioration of the surfaces because the rifle had not been properly cleaned, lubricated, and maintained. For the same reasons, the panel was unable to identify its test bullets with those of the FBI.
Well, I've got a PS on that. That's bullshit. That's straight up bullshit.
Is that a technical term?
Yeah, that's a firearms term we use sometimes. Yeah.
I don't claim to be an expert. Can you see the?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a. I'll show you the pictures. I have a Carcano that I did not test myself because I do not have firearms expertise, nor did I think at the time I had enough knowledge to know whether firing was a safe act. But I put it in the hands of a close friend who is expert in ballistics and firearms and so forth. And this is the ammunition he used. It's the same 164 grain or so copper jacketed Carcano ammunition. This is my rifle. The only difference is that the bolt handle, as is frequently found, is perpendicular to the bolt. It hasn't got a bent bolt handle as in the school book depository or the rifle from Dallas. And my comment to Brian, and this again is not coming from an expert, but I was trying to recall my conversations, was the guy mounted this rifle on a tripod because he was fearful when he examined the bolt that the retaining pin on the bolt would possibly fail and the bolt
right.
would fall out the back. He didn't
yeah.
want to have his body near that.
Yeah.
I have looked at mine and I think it's possible, but I don't know about the metal fatigue. He fired it 4 or 5 times and it had been estimated not to have been fired since late 1940s, early 1950. And the first 3 or 4 rounds he commented was this is not good, and then after that it fired fine every time after that. So to the point I think Brian is making, unless this is subjected to an extremely humid environment with even potential of corrosives, the inside of the barrel is likely not to be affected. But even if it is, a couple of firings at projectiles that when they were new were probably traveling in excess of 200 feet per second probably does a pretty good job of cleaning it out.
Right.
In the end, as a side point, which is a whole other 4-hour discussion, it wasn't very accurate. And notice that there is no scope on this rifle. So he was using the iron sight to just put it down range into a broad target. It was a berm, you know, a wood. So this is, again, you know, what it looks like. And I was trying to make a comment here about the whole routine of the rifle being brought in, you know, tucked under the armpit,
yeah,
as supposedly curtain rods.
This is the infantry version this is the infantry version. It's a lot longer than the Carcano that supposedly was in evidence.
So
it's a different configuration, by the way.
Where's the difference? Let me bring up
go back to that last slide you had, right there.
Where
your point right there, where at the 2 foot mark. If you can enlarge that just a little bit.
I don't sure I can.
Up here at your magnifying glass at the top of your picture.
There you go. Thank
click
you.
That, and then you get a slider that'll show. There, keep going.
Yeah, it won't go any further, unfortunately.
Okay. At the 1 foot, at the 2 foot mark, you see a built-in sight adjustment for the rifle. That's different. That wasn't on the Oswald's rifle. You already mentioned the carriage handle is straight, which is awkward as hell.
Very awkward.
Yeah, this is the infantry version of the same rifle. It's a 9138 Carcano. That's just a little bit different. I noticed, do you have a picture of the left side of the stock?
Unfortunately, I did not lie it that way. I could show you one next week, or I could take a picture with my phone.
Because I noticed the swivels are on the bottom of that rifle at the rear and at the front. And, as we know, the rifle that Fritz or that Day is carrying out had a side mount in the stock, which tells me that was more of a lightweight gun to, you know, guys who carry over the shoulder in field combat.
Is this version that you're seeing here, Brian, longer in total length from butt to tip?
Well, it looks like it's right at 40 inches.
This is 40 inches.
But it's a different configuration as far as the chambering goes and the firing mechanisms in that front alignment, sight alignment right at the 2 foot mark.
Okay.
Yeah.
And about the same weight that you think?
Oh yeah. It's a heavy rifle.
Right.
Yeah.
I actually pulled the firing pin out and I put a brass shim over it so it could not be fired even accidentally. Oh, I was too fearful of it.
And could you go back to the pictures you had of the shells? Yeah. Let me take a look at that real quick. You notice go back one.
Looking at the indentation.
Yeah, right there with the clip. Somewhere in the world that clip is in evidence or somebody's pocket, but that's the copper, the brass one is the one that was issued with the gun, but apparently it wasn't bought when Oswald sent away for the money order for that rifle, because it said a clip and a box of ammo was extra.
Yeah.
So wherever he got the clip, that's a good question. But for those of us who don't know how this Carcano works, go back to your picture of your rifle again. Yeah, the clip goes underneath. You have to manually force it into the firing chamber, into the breech, and then you have to lock and load one, and then gravity will take effect and push with the spring at the bottom of that clip will push the next round up as you eject the one that's been fired. And when you load the last round, the magazine is supposed to fall through the open bottom of that firing chamber, so that tells you that you are out of ammunition, this is your last shot. So that picture of Fritz or Day taking that rifle out of the book depository with something hanging out of the bottom, that's not the clip. I don't know what the hell that is, but that's not the magazine, because it wouldn't stay in there. It would fall through. It's supposed to fall through.
Yeah, you can probably see in the just at the front of the trigger guard, there's a piece of copper wire. And I have that actually holding back the retention spring or forcing the shells into there. I just wanted to not tempt anybody. It turns out that the shells and the rifle are in the same room in my home, but nobody else is here. I always think about safety. You know?
That's a good defense. Have somebody pick that up and aim it at somebody, it'll never work.
Yeah. I actually have gotten permission to, I use this as a prop at my presentations. And I had spoken before. Last time I spoke was 2 years ago at a local college. had a big audience. And I actually got permission from the head of security and the local police, even though there are very strict rules about firearms in any kind of educational setting in New York State. I got permission to bring this to the presentation and then take it out. And you might find what, you know, none of you will be surprised by this, but those who I oversaw to pick up the rifle and hold it, they were stunned at its overall weight and unwieldiness. And even though I had showed them 4 hours of slides and questions about the whole 6 seconds, it wasn't until they actually have this in their hand that, at least for some of them, there was a very instant sense of the recognition of what in their mind was unlikely that it could have been used or anything like this could have been used at that distance, even with the off-centered sight that was on the supposed rifle. So anyway, that was my experience with it.
There are photographs in Volume 7 beginning around page 382, but interestingly, there are no optical images of the inside of the rifle, and the four bullets that they have that they tested, they have two bullets from the side view and the four from the front, you know, if you're looking at the tip back. So their recommendation is that all foreign material should be removed from C-139 with a mild solution of saline or hemosoil, and it should be handled with cotton gloves going forward. There's also a whole section on the pistol. Yeah, you can actually tell Bob about your experience with the rifle with the mock trial.
that was a shaky ground. I brought that in to the court, and the judge, I demonstrated how it works and the time span between firing and injecting and firing again. And Larry, you're talking about when the judge asked me if I'd ever fired it.
No. What you had to do to bring it on the plane and bring it into school.
Oh, my God.
Good God, yeah.
That's like going to the National Archives and trying to get a document. They want 12 pieces of identification. One of the things I learned is when you go to the counter and you're carrying a rifle bag or a hard case, you don't go up and say, I have a gun. Not a good idea. Just say, I have a weapon that I want to check through. I almost found myself in a little room with multiple people going, so you're bringing a gun on a plane, and you're stupid enough to tell everybody about it? You need to stay here.
I had a problem. In 1993, I decided to wear a replica of a Confederate general's uniform to a Halloween party. And I had purchased a replica of an 1862 Colt revolver. And I had it in the holster on my belt. And when I got to the apartment building, I realized I had forgotten to buy something for the party. So I walked into a little deli to buy something, and I put my holster on top of the counter. The guy, hysterical. Not a good idea.
Yeah, you got to be careful about that.
I guess, Brian, you mentioned the rifle case. And you probably told the person, well, you were doing that because you didn't want them to get upset about the knife and the explosives that you were carrying.
Right. They totally missed that. I mean, they didn't. But I had to disassemble the rifle. When I got to the ticket counter, she sent me over to another section. And I never, you know, I was a cop for 22 years, and I never carried a weapon on a plane because I never went anywhere as a cop. But there were people carrying large diameter gun cases, like, you know, every fourth passenger was getting on that plane with a rifle. You know, I felt like I was in the middle of Deliverance or something. But anyway, you had to fill out a piece of paper. You had to get a TSA approved lock. You had to have a TSA approved gun case. You had to take the rifle apart, remove the bolt, and I had to remove the scope and put that in separate boxes, and then I had to take any bullets that I had, and we got this approved prior to the trial, the mock trial. I had six bullets. I had to put each of them in a separate box, and it has to be sealed. And then they would open it before they put it in the, on the gangplank to get, you know, get it down to the plane. Then they resealed it in my presence and then sent it. And then, of course, you weren't allowed to watch it to make sure it gets on the plane. And that was my greatest fear, is that some, you know, $1.45 an hour baggage handler is going, hey, there's a rifle, let's take it. You know, and it's a whole piece of shit, but, you know, it was my rifle. So, anyway, there are many like it, but that one's fine. So,
yeah. Brian, how long would it take you if you were sitting on a sixth floor at 12:15? How long would it take you to assemble that rifle, and what would you need to do? Could you do it with a coin, or because I don't, you know, there's no evidence Oswald had a screwdriver on him.
Well, first of all,
Ian Griggs, you want to talk about?
First of all, I would never take it apart. If I
clearly the package he had wasn't long enough to hold the rifle.
So somebody's going to bring it in there for me, or I'm going to find out how to get it in there at night. I'm not taking the damn thing apart because I may not have time to put it together. You know, so it's going to come in already assembled. So as far as taking it apart, I've never taken mine apart, but it's not that many pieces to it. I think Ian Griggs did a great article about how long it took him with the screwdriver and then how long it took him with a quarter. But to me, that makes no sense tactically to take the rifle apart. When I was on the sniper team, we're talking about the cleaning part of the gun, we would fire 12, 15, 25, 30 rounds every time we'd go out, and we'd do a light cleaning. We don't want to take all of that lead residue out because that's going to, you know, it's going to allow the bullet to do a little wobbling or rolling or yawing that we don't want it. We don't practice that way, so we do a light cleaning. But this rifle was supposedly cleaned at some point because it was left in an environment that had moisture in it, but apparently they didn't take care of it as well as I did on mine. But
Brian, my question, I'm just trying to show you, so what you said makes sense, but what the narrative is that there was no evidence that he brought it any other day,
right,
or that anyone else, so we're faced with the fact that if Williams is there till 12:15 and doesn't hear any noise about anyone assembling the rifle, then he has to assemble it in 15 minutes, also build a sniper nest. But
right.
But given the facts that were given, it means that he would have had to assemble a rifle. And how do you test it? And I guess he's stuck with what, using coins to do it?
Yeah, that's what they speculated, that he used coins. They found no tools nearby.
Right.
But, you know, when you put a rifle and a scope together, you usually want to test fire it to make sure your scope is aligned with the barrel. Was that done?
No.
Was that done at all? We don't know. But I think Ian said on his study, I think he said it put it together in 10 minutes or 10 to 12 minutes. He was able to put it together with a nickel.
Wow.
Or something, but
Brian, that article, I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I've got it. Oh, okay. Collection.
Brian, could you speculate a little on the value of disassembling this rifle? I mean, the difference between the stock is one piece of wood,
right?
And it's 47 or 37 of the 40 inches long,
right?
And so, from the point of view of in some way hindering observation of bringing in and or out of the building, I can't tell the value added. In fact, that's why I had that measuring
device. Bob, it's the fact that whatever testimony is there indicates that the bag that he brought in that was seen him bring into the car and also walking into the building was not big enough to hold an assembled rifle.
Right.
Now, obviously, the bag that they walked out of the building with, which, by the way, wasn't seen in any photographs, was big enough to hold an assembled rifle.
Right.
So the argument is the only kind of rifle that Oswald could have brought into the building that day was in disassembled condition.
Right. But that's the question I'm raising to all of you, which is that in disassembled condition, it still couldn't have been secreted in the way that at least a testimony of observations of this right. under the armpit to the folded fingers of the right hand.
Were, well, let's assume for the
night. It's not even close. It's not even close.
Well, I think there's sufficient vagueness in Fraser's testimony because he wasn't questioned properly. And the only, you know, so ostensibly, even if you could, let's say that you, you know, get past that, you could convince the jury that he brought something into the building. And what is it if he didn't bring a rifle, right? So there's an inference there. He brought something. He said it was curtain rods, but then they have testimony. So, but if he brought it in a disassembled state, that even itself creates lots of problems. But I know what you're saying. Even a disassembled rifle didn't seem to match.
And the weight of the rifle makes it, the handling of it awkward in any way. But even with the bottom-heavy nature of the rifle, that is, if it's in a vertical position, you're holding your hand around the stock, you have to secure the upper part of that rifle in some way, or it's going to fall over just by its own inertial weight of all of the metal stuff, which is...
And it would jingle and make noise. It's not going to be like, you know...
And to Brian's part, I didn't want to attempt to disassemble it in any complete way, but I only remember it being in three pieces or four pieces at the most.
Yeah. Well, you've got the stock is a separate piece. You've got the scope is a separate piece. It's detachable. Then you've got the firing chamber. That comes out in two pieces. There's a part, the lower receiver will come out from the bottom and the upper receiver, will come off the top. So you've got basically four major components of that rifle.
Okay.
Now, and are any of those parts, do any of those parts, when they're exposed, have oil on them, or is it all internal, the oil?
Well, if a gun owner was competent, I don't know why he picked that piece of crap in the first place, but if the owner was competent, wanted to keep the integrity of the rifle, you're going to have a little bit of oil on it. You're not going to drown it in oil because oil draws dust and debris. So you want to keep that down to a minimum. When we fired our rifles or on the department, we would do, like I said, we do a light clean. We would partly maybe not even put a drop of oil in the barrel because it would draw dust and moisture and all that. So
I wonder, did Ian, like when he took it apart, did he put it in the bag to see whether it would leave any oil stains?
I'm gonna have to look, Larry. He did an article for I think the third or fourth decade, and he has a.
Oh, okay.
In fact, you go on Bart's website, it's got the Ian Griggs collection. I think there's an article in there.
Because I don't think anyone had even, I mean, so the government says it wouldn't left oil, but did anyone ever actually take a Carcano, disassemble it, put it in a bag, and see what would happen? And I don't think that was done.
I thought
the evidence indicated that they did not discover anything that looked like an oil stain.
Right, right. And so the question is, if it was in fact disassembled, would it in fact have left oil?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anyone has actually, they take apart a rifle and see, okay, you know, there's all assumptions here.
There's always going to be, you know, in trace evidence and forensic, there's always going to be something left when two objects come together. Even if it's a trace, minus microscopic trace of oil, or some type of lubricant, it's probably going to be on that bag because it's set horizontal in the back of the car.
Right.
At some point, there's going to be transfer of oil or gun clean solution or whatever on the inside of that bag. Did they investigate the inside of the bag? Well, first of all, we've already got testimony from Randall and Buell Fraser that it wasn't the same size as the bag, so that throws that bag out. And then Bob mentioned the bag coming out, or you mentioned the bag coming out. Montgomery's holding that bag. Son of a bitch, it's vertical, and then what's in it? What's holding it upright? And that bag is probably the length of the rifle.
Right.
It's got two or three folds in it, too.
Right.
But that,
right.
Yeah, there's folds in it. So obviously it didn't hold anything taller than that first fold. Otherwise, unless it was a magazine article or something, or a fold-out or something, but... That picture has always bothered me, is where the hell did you get that bag? There's no picture of it at the crime scene in the corner, and no officer testified that they saw a bag, and there's no picture of a bag, but yet we have a Studebaker's picture with dotted lines drawn on the picture of the sniper's nest, and this is his testimony is, this is where I saw the bag. Well, where the hell is the bag?
And we have no no evidence that Oswald had any oils, any kind of rightful cleaning or oil, you know, in his possessions.
And I don't believe that was a bag that was in the shape of a long, narrow bag that was purchased commercially. My recollection was it was constructed out of craft paper in some way.
Yes. I think the reason it had its shape was because of the tape they used to put it together. So it was almost like, you know, I don't know, but it was holding that shape because of the tape that put it together.
Didn't one of the FBI guys say when they looked at it, said the weapon was well oiled, but yet there was no oil inside? We don't know if they tested the inside of that bag. They would do that now. I mean, they're convicting people on trace evidence is no bigger than the width of a hair. I mean, certainly you would find out there's evidence of some kind, an impression, oil marks, or any kind of, you know, the two bolts, the bolt and firing chamber and the barrel itself, you would have to hold on to all that and the stock to keep that from dropping through the bag, I would think. I mean, this is like a lunch bag. I mean, this isn't something that's it's not impossible to break through, but you know, I don't believe Buell Frazier as far as I can throw my house, but you know, he did testify for us that basically said that that's not the same size the bag I saw. So,
and Brian, does a Mauser disassemble the same way?
It depends on what model it is. There's rifles basically come apart the same way. Most of them come apart the same way. The stock is separate from the firing part. The metal and wood are put together, but the metal contains two or three parts, and the wood has got one part. So, yeah. And then, again, you got the scope issue. You know, how do you know that thing's lined up with the barrel? Did you test fire it upstairs in the sixth floor before you fired it out the window?
And then, of course, the answer to that is, well, he didn't use the scope. He used the sight at the end of the barrel.
Brian, could I ask you another question from your ballistics expertise? This is related to the brass plate and the ammunition. When I put four rounds in the clip, not six, and try to just handle it carefully in a pocket and let it, every time I recovered it within seconds, all of the rounds were all in various positions in the clip, to the point where two of them actually came out on their own.
Right. You have to have a full complement to make it be able to slide up in the firing chamber. If you put three or four in there, like you said, your fingers can't get up inside there and hold those while you're pushing the clip up in the inside. I tried it, I don't know, 50, 60 times to put one shell in there, two shells. It won't work because that firing or that spring clip on the bottom of the inside of the firing chamber will push up on that bottom bullet. And if there's nothing there to hold it, you can't put your finger inside and push it up. It's just impossible to do that.
So it begs the question, you know, was the clip already in the against the retaining spring before it was brought in, and even begs the question how it was even done at all. I mean, how does somebody go in with just four rounds to begin with? David, you know, you're the administrator of this. I don't want to get off onto another whole tangent, but so many of these aspects from a non-ballistics expert, i.e. me, have just raised the question of just the simple logic of how devices work together, metal against metal, metal against wood, and how they're supposed to work and then how they do. And, you know, again, coming back to me is my ballistics friend, I won't repeat his name, but he said he had no idea how somebody would load fewer than six rounds in a full clip in any safe and accurate and predictable manner in this rifle. That's what he told me. Now, this is...
I think Roger McCarthy test, when we were getting him, considering him for our mock trial, I think he said he had done it with less, but I have to double check.
Well, I know it can be done. The question is, why would it have been done? Why would somebody, with the scenario that's been presented, walk into this facility with four rounds, where did those rounds come from? I mean, there's no, it's not even a chain of evidence. To my knowledge, there's been no acknowledged and verified source of this ammunition.
No.
If we say with any certainty that, and just for the sake of argument, that rifle, that magazine, that clip had to be fully loaded with six rounds, okay? So you fire four, where are the other two? Where are those at? Where are those?
Why would anyone come into that building with less than a full, load of bullets?
Unless you're a good shot like I was, I just take one bullet, I'm done.
Right.
No, you'd take a full complement, and then you'd have, like I said, you eject three. Where are the other two full rounds go?
And then to take an effort to hide the rifle, but not to hide the shells is another hole. There's so many inconsistencies.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly uncertainty about how shells respond in any ejection sequence from any rifle, as far as I know. And I don't know there's any specific information about the Carcano, but the several different pictures of the shell locations on the floor are seemingly weird, at least, again, applying common sense and logic. From an expert's point of view, I don't know, but it just seems like that where the shell casings were found didn't make sense, and the markings on the shell casings suggested some things that also were inconsistent.
Well, when your friend fired that rifle and he ejected the shells, did he forcibly eject it and then ram the firing, I lost my train of thought.
The bolt.
He threw the bolt forward again for the next round. Did you notice how far away that shell ended up?
I do not remember that. It was decades ago.
I can tell you that just from dry firing it and putting six weighted shells in that clip and putting it into the firing chamber and ejecting those shells in a forceful manner like you had, time was of the essence, it went up to 20 feet away.
Wow.
Even if I did an experiment. I think I did this at Casey's house or someplace. I stood next to a wall or the outside of his house or somebody's house, and I ejected those rounds, and they bounced off. They're like super balls. And they never ended up anywhere close to 2 inches apart facing the same direction. That's absolutely impossible. There's no odds that would ever happen.
Where does the energy come from that launches the shells? Is it strictly the operation of the bolt and the spring?
It's the operation of the bolt, how hard you pull that bolt back, and it's also got a spring on the inside that kicks it. That will kick it out regardless of how fast you pull back or how hard you pull back, but it's going to kick it out always at the same speed. It just depends on how hard you pull the bolt. You can pull it back so that the bolt goes this slow, or you can pull it back and it goes that fast. It's still going to come out, but it's going to come out at a different rate. It's going to come out at a different distance. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the movie, Jack Reacher, where Tom Cruise is on the firing line with Robert Duvall, and he's proned out, and he loads the weapon with one hand, and then he ejects the round, and he catches it in his finger, and you notice how slow he pulls that bolt back. He catches the round, or catches the shell in his hand, and he puts it in the box and grabs another one. But in this situation, for those bolts, for those shell casings to come out, you've got 7 seconds or 8 seconds to fire three rounds. You're going to be pulling them out pretty fast because you've got to require your target. You've got to find your target against that 2.5-degree scope. Those shells are going to go far. If they're not bouncing off an object or a structure nearby on your right side, they're going to be everywhere.
And you can't be ejecting forcefully with the bolt action and have the scope, eyepiece against your eye.
No.
So just the physical movement, all of that. So I've always been curious about how those shells ended up. I think I remember who was making the point.
There's one theory that Tom Alea, is that how you pronounce his name? Alea?
Yeah.
When he got Yeah, when he said he got to the crime scene, Fritz was already holding the shells, and he said, hey, you know, I heard from the guys in the back that you found some shell casings or evidence, whatever it was. And he said Fritz just showed his, opened his hand, and he had three of the shell casings in his hand, in his palm. And Aaliyah took a picture, a motion picture frame or two of that, and then Fritz threw them on the ground. That's what he said. And at 6th Floor Museum, his oral history, that's what he said. So obviously somebody's falsified the pictures in that crime scene photo. You know, whenever those were taken, they staged that. They went back three times to take pictures and restate this, move these boxes. And there was more prints on the boxes of cops and unidentified people than there was of Oswald, who supposedly had access to the building in every floor. So
I'm sure all of you do too, but I have 6 different box configurations from that particular window. That 3 of them supposedly official pictures, and 3 of them from, I was not able to verify, I think, all of the sources of news pictures. But yeah, Brian, thank you so much for your insights. Sure. This is really solidified things that I haven't looked at.
One safety tip for you: don't fire that rifle yourself. Oh,
I will never fire. I didn't fire it back in the 70s.
Yeah,
and as I mentioned, it's now unfireable. I mean, when I say unfireable, I didn't saw off the tip of the firing pin, but I put a shim around it so it will not penetrate the breech.
Well, I keep it in my office in case somebody breaks into the house, because I'll hit them on the head with it, or fix drywall screws that are coming out of the top of my room.
It's funny because I have, you know, all the pictures I showed you are
a deadly weapon at last.
Yeah.
I'm not a firearms person. You know, I have, my family's in law enforcement, but I'm just not into that. But I have all of that stuff. And to your point, what do I have next to my bed upstairs is a Daisy BB gun. Cause I think it'll be more effective.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the story is that rifle was found on the battlefields next to dead soldiers and had half their face blown off because the bolt came back. So that was the deadliest weapon ever made, not to kill anybody that they were aiming at. So.
Absolutely, and I had actually heard some other people say, this is my dad was born in 23 and he served in the Navy, and I remember a comment from somebody that he knew in the Navy that said that Italian soldiers who were issued some of these early on were actually throwing them away and trying to get weapons through the, you know, through the Nazi underground, you know, the Axis underground, and were using those versus the ones that were issued.
The story of multiple serial numbers being issued, or same serial numbers issued at different plants that were in Italy were making these weapons, and that's why there's multiple, the same serial numbers could be on more than one rifle. So that's unusual. That's not the protocol of today, but back then there was a war effort, and they, as fast as they could churn them out, nobody knew that Factory A was putting the same numbers on the ones at Factory B. So, and that's why you could buy 100 of them for, you know, $50 at wholesale.
On the issue of safety, do you think I'm okay holding on to the loaded ammunition that I have?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yeah. So I just have that drilled out. I can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ammunition will deteriorate over time. And that's the other thing about that ammunition. That was World War II surplus ammunition. Why would you pick a gun that was manufactured in 1891? Second of all, what's the point of the scope? And it's plastic. You can't see through it for shit. And then three, you've got rifling, or you've got bullets that were manufactured 40 years or 20 years before. They will degrade over time. The you know, it'll be a poof instead of a bang. But yeah, you can keep that. Keep those shells, because those are worth something someday.
You know, it strikes me with all of the phenomenal effort that all of you and all the people who've already ducked out of today's meeting have thought about. I just think about the last 15, 20 minutes of conversation, and if I was a layperson listening into this thing, just on this discussion alone, I'd already be convinced. And I mean, I know I'm being oversimplifying and having spent a lot of time in it, you would think that any of these focused conversations, particularly on ballistics, this rifle, all the things that you've referred to, would be so convincing, and particularly if they were in a court of law.
Well, Well, that was,
alas,
that was our purpose.
This is why he was killed. This is why he was killed, because he was not convictable.
Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead,
Ken. Am I on?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to tell you, Bob, to reiterate a little bit what Brian was saying, but go ahead and look up the history of this weapon back for the Italians, because the Italians, their infantry, there was more people being killed by the weapon itself because of the bolts. And so what they had to do is collect all those weapons up and rebarrel that particular weapon to a 7.62, even a 6.72 or something like that, but in order for them to be able to fight in the war. So, you know, we have a problem with that even back during the end of World War I and the beginning of World War II. Also, to throw a little light on this after Brian and I were down there in Dallas for several years, he says, you know, the only thing that this rifle would do, at least possibility of killing Kennedy, was for Oswald to have thrown the damn thing out in the motorcade and accidentally hit JFK in the goddamn head. He says, this rifle wouldn't do a damn thing. So I'll keep that in the back of your mind also.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have learned that early on, Casey, and that's the reason why. I mean, I would have already taken the step even when I was young, but the cautiousness of handling the rifle, and as Brian advised me or was saying, I hope that your friend fired it in a controlled way and that I should never fire today. I did know all of that back then. I have no idea with my aversion to firearms why I took an interest in this, but it must be obviously related to the case. But I appreciate your insights into it. Thank you.
Larry, I was really interrupt real quick. I don't know how long ago, I think I got this at one of the ASC conferences back in the 80s or 70s. It's called the Carcano, and then I can't read it upside down, but it's the Italy military rifle by Richard Hobbs. Is that Richard? Yeah, Richard Hobbs. And it's probably got, well, it does have, I don't know, got 64 pages doing the history of that rifle, of how it became what it became, and why they changed models, and the serial numbers were, and who used them and who didn't use them. And, I mean, it's got great drawings of the ammo box or the rifle that supposedly was found. And it's a real good book. I don't even know if you can get that anywhere anymore.
You are going to scan that so we can put that on our archive. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But I have to take it apart. So.
Hey, we've got a flatbed scanner. We can scan page by page.
Right.
Real quick, Bob, I was going to tell you, and you can try this with just a standard tape measure. We were talking earlier about the bag, how long the bag was, and if it would be wise to take the weapon apart to even carry it under the armpit to the tip of the fingers. We'd have to go back and look at Oswald's size and how long his arms were, but I just measured quick, crude measurement of mine, and from my armpit to the tip of my fingers to where I could actually hold something in my hand was about 25 inches. And that stock alone that you were showing was 37 inches just for the stock. So, the likelihood that he could have carried that rifle underneath his arm, even in a broke-down fashion, it's not possible.
Right. So the only logical way one would carry it would be in a military position, right, where the top end rests on the front shoulder. On the back shoulder, again, momentum is and gravity are not your friend. And so there was no evidence suggesting that, despite the questionable observations made. So, yeah, to your point, David, when I would make the comments about the size of the rifle in my presentation, people really are, it's not a measurement people are aware of, which is what is the distance between your armpit and the length of your hand. And even if you are an NBA basketball player, there are not too many people who have 37 inches.
I wonder if there was a if the Oswald autopsy has length of his arm.
Well, I tell you what we can do. We could probably take the photograph and use Google's AI to measure from, just like you do on a map, measure from the tip of his, you know, from the like probably the first knuckle of his fingertip up to his armpit and see if it gives us a measurement in inches.
We've got homework assignments.
Bob, I think the rifle that you have that you showed on your thing is the Model 91. That's the only one, the only Carcano that has a straight bolt of that length.
That Model 91 is popping, you know, a neuron or two just connected, Brian. So you're the highlight of my weekend. I actually have a new neuron connection at the level of the last 6 months.
Yeah, and for some reason, they changed the extractor bolt to a curved bolt at some point during the infantry stage of the manufacture to make it so that it doesn't get caught on anything. It's closer to the stock, and it doesn't get caught on trees when you're going into the forest or whatever. But I'm pretty sure that yours is the Model 91.
And it's extremely awkward to operate it,
yeah.
Even from a non-expert like myself.
Yeah.
And let me ask you this, are the bolts interchangeable? You can actually find the, you know, the angled handle bolts separately in certain forums, and I thought about getting one for accuracy, but I was concerned that it wouldn't fit.
I don't know. It might be of a different length. It's not going to be any wider because it's got the same rifling characteristics of the 9138, but, you know, How much is the bolt? I'd be curious.
It was $40.
It might be interchangeable. I mean, the rifling lugs on the firing chamber itself are going to be in about the same position. So I would, you know, it's a $40 investment to make it look like more like the Carcano. But again, your model is 91, and Oswald's was 9138. So there is a difference in the size and style of the rifling. Of the configuration of the rifle.
Hey, Brian, Exhibit CE-540 is a sulfur cast of the interior of the barrel of the rifle. Have you ever seen that?
Give me the CE number again.
CE-540.
And it's, what is it? Describe it.
It's a sulfur cast of interior of the barrel of, you know, of the 139.
Really? I'm going to look that up.
I don't know what a sulfur cast would show, you know.
Well, it's probably going to be showing the primary, the lands and the grooves on the inside and the direction of the twist and the amount of twist. But as far as, you know, it's like a plaster cast of a footprint or a tire impression. It, when you turn it over, it's going to show you all the minute details. And it may have lead residue on that. It would have all kinds of debris of antimony or any kind of gunpowder residue. But that wouldn't be seen on that plaster cast. But I'll certainly look that up. CE-540. I didn't know there was such a
and
thing.
And if one took an image, would it be sufficient? Well, why don't you take a look at it first? And I'm just trying to think whether that would be something that could be scanned. I don't know how accurate a sulfur cast is of the interior. You know, of the interior.
Is it a picture of like a cotton swab that they stuck down it? The barrel, or is this a full?
I don't have it in front of me. I just see that there was a. I'm looking at the list of exhibits.
Okay.
You know, Frazier said that they fired. I'm just looking at how many rounds were fired. It's at least 100 rounds that they fired of the bullet. But
that's going to show some residue. If they put a sulfur cast in. I never heard of such a thing, but. Maybe that was the days before plaster, but that isn't the way you would. You'd have to. The best way to do that would be cut the barrel in half and look at it. Put a bore scope down it so you can see it. I mean, as far as being able to recognize, that's what I thought. Now, see, that doesn't tell us anything. It's dirtier than hell.
This is coming off of a commission exhibit 540.
540.
And let me see if I can increase.
Oh yeah, look at that. Yeah.
That tells me that rifle was pretty damn dirty.
Is that white to begin with?
Well, that should be white. Should be a brush. If this is just a cotton swab or whatever, it might have been a sterile cloth to put down there. It's going to pick up all that trace evidence inside that barrel. I don't know what that is on the front and why it's not covered.
That that might be the probably what was that was probably the I guess whatever portion didn't go into the barrel.
Yeah. Did anybody ever testify about what that showed? I'd be curious to see what Frazier's story is about that.
Yeah, you know, I don't have I just have a list of the visits I have to see.
Yeah, I remember this. I remember this, but it doesn't tell you a damn thing. It doesn't say, you know, this is a swab down the barrel of the Carcano in evidence, and it shows that it's, you know, been used and fired, and it's very dirty. But that's not going to prevent it from being fired.
Hey, if you ever are get around to or you're inclined to scan that Hobbs document, love to see it. Dave has already rattled your cage on it.
I'll scan it and we'll put it on the website.
Brian, would that suggest though that could a rifle be fired? I mean, in other words, would a rifle have cleaned it out enough that it wouldn't be that dirty?
Yeah.
Would a bullet have cleaned it out?
The firing, the actual explosion of the gunpowder inside would burn some of that crap away. But if that rifle was that dirty, I'd be embarrassed for the holder of that rifle. There's no sense of having it that dirty. It's not going to block the bullet. I mean, the bullet's going to come out. It may come out the back too, but, the only way to stop that bullet from coming out is plug it on the end. But yeah, you're going to fire through all that dirt and shit. It'll be right.
It wouldn't get burned off or cleaned out by the
right.
bullet.
Right.
Through the barrel. Okay.
That's why it's important after you fire a gun, if you want to maintain the working capability of that firearm, you clean it right after you fire it. Because the longer that lead and antimony sits in that copper sits in that barrel, the more it's going to start crusting, and you know it's going to affect your first round you shoot the next time.
In terms of the alleged statement that Lucy said that the rifle was not barred, it was dirty, that's not an accurate statement.
Sure, I mean you can fire a dirty weapon. Sure,
okay.
Yeah, not going to hurt. In fact, firing multiple rounds through it is probably going to help clean it out. It might make it loose, and then you can put a good swab through it and clean all that shit out of there. But yeah,
okay. Yeah.
A dirty rifle is just as accurate, just as good to in somebody's hands as a clean rifle.
Okay.
But boy, there's a lot of heat generated, you know, in the breech of that barrel. So
yeah.
I'm sure that. I mean, maybe I'm not sure. Let me rephrase it as a question, Brian. If you fire a round or two in a dirty rifle, would that improve the likelihood of being able to clean it more thoroughly?
It would help. Yeah.
Okay.
It would help.
Okay.
If you get it right after it's been hot.
Okay.
Like when we practiced, it's called a cold bore shot. You get one shot, you haven't fired it since the last time you fired it, and that's probably not going to be as accurate as the when the barrel warms up. But the reason for a cold bore shot is to see if your scope and your barrel are in line with each other. And the hotter your barrel gets, the more accurate you're going to get as far as rounds go and on the same line of sight as your barrel. But yeah, cleaning a barrel is important to keep all that rust and shit from growing in there.
Bob, when you test fired this, do you remember any
smoke
coming out of the barrel or smoke coming out of the barrel?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Casey. I mean, if I answered yes or no, it would be disingenuous. It's too long ago. But I would think that with the amount of accelerant in the base of this ammunition that you – certainly if it was dark, you would see a considerable – visual evidence of the bullet coming out of the barrel, but I don't remember back then smoke or flame.
The reason I ask you that is because if you do this another time, take a good look at the end of the barrel and see what emits out of there. Because when we had our students on the firing range, of course we weren't firing a 6.5. But we were firing 30-06s and 7.65s. But I remember there's about 30 students. And so one of the questions I asked them, I said, how many of you saw fire emit out of the barrel of the rifle? And they all looked at me, and they go, no, we didn't see any of it. I said, well, were you paying attention to that? And they go, no, we weren't. I said, okay, Well, then let's fire another set of rounds. So we fired another set of rounds, and guess what? Fire is coming out, and also smoke.
And that smoke, you know, powderless cartridges, in other words, the old manufacturers, the World War II ammunition, that era, is going to be pretty smoky. But you couple a World War II vintage round or an older round that's been sitting in a box for 40 years, and you fire it through a dirty barrel, you're going to get a lot more exhaust, you're going to get a lot more smoke, you're going to get a lot of dirty smoke coming out because it's burning what's in there already. And then you're also going to have the bullet, if it's going through a dirty rifle, it's going to produce its own dirt. So there is going to be dirt coming out of, not actual dirt, but there's going to be dark smoke. The darker, the heavier, the dirtier the barrel, the heavier the smoke's going to be, basically.
There's a corollary to that, and this is sort of ironic in a way. I've spent 35 years as a professional pyrotechnician and doing fireworks displays, granted they're with wide bore mortars, but the concept is very similar, and exactly what you were describing, Brian, is the experience that we have. Related to the amount of smoke, the amount of fire associated directly with the cleanliness of the mortars, any residue that's left over, and all the other factors that, you know, are in, including the space between the projectile and the mortar inside diameter. Not particularly relevant to firearms, but concepts are similar. And certainly the powder that has been in these shells since the 1930s.
Yeah.
The number of unburned particles of combustion in those things has got to be far greater than a modern formulation that's coming out of a ammunition manufacturing process,
right.
Particularly the smokeless powder.
And a lot of that debris is going to be left in that barrel.
Yeah.
And it's unburnt and it's just starting to crystallize and eventually will just clog up the glands and grooves and making it more difficult to clean. You'd have to have it professionally clean unless you know what the hell you're doing. You take an electric bore and just bore it out again. But nobody keeps a firearm long enough to have that done. If they're cleaning it after they fire it, you're not going to have all that buildup.
So, Brian, Frazier testified that he's the one that did the sulfur cap in order to use a micrometer to determine the land width and groove width in the barrel. And then he goes on. They don't ask him anything about
how big is it.
They don't ask him anything about the quality of anything about that cast. Then when he talks about the condition of the bullet of the rifle, he says McCloy asks him, "Was it what you would call pitted? Were the lands in good shape?" Mr. Frazier says, "No, sir. The lands and the grooves were worn, the corners were worn, and the interior of the surface were roughened from corrosion or wear." Then McCoy says, "Was there any metal fouling in the barrel? I did not examine it for that."
Oh, well, that's pretty important to do that when you examine a rifle to find out. That tells me, just that little snippet that you read, and I've read it before too, that tells me that rifle wasn't cleaned at all, at any time. That there's that much pitting and the grooves and lands were worn down. That somebody fired the shit out of that rifle.
Then McCoy asks him, "How many rounds do you think were fired?" He said, "I cannot, because the number of rounds is not an indication of the condition of the barrel. Since if the barrel was allowed to rust, one round will remove the rust and wear the barrel to the same extent as 10 or 15 or 50 rounds just fired through the barrel."
Right.
Interesting. So there's nothing. They had like two sentences on Exhibit 540, and then they moved on.
That's an important thing, and they could have saved a whole hell of a lot of time and had Fritz or Dave stuck his big fat nose down there and smell it and go, "This rifle's been recently fired." Mm-hmm. They didn't do that. That didn't cost anything, didn't require any technology involved. Just stick your fat nose down in front of it.
See, this is what happens when you don't have cross-examination. When you have one lawyer that's, first of all, only asking convenient questions to get to a certain point, and then, you know, they don't follow up because they're not looking for information that would go the wrong way, and you don't have an attorney then asking the expert these kinds of questions, and that's why the record is the way it is.
Yeah.
I know this is a question for another time, but I don't remember seeing anybody or any eyewitnesses or ear witnesses saying that they are, I should say eyewitnesses, seeing that they saw fire emit from the rifle that supposedly was fired from the Oswald window or smoke. But there was a hell of a lot of people that said there was fire and smoke coming from the North Grassy Knoll, so on the picket fence line. So, like I said, that would be another discussion for another time. But then it kind of insinuates that, well, obviously, was Oswald on the fence line shooting at the president from the North Grassy Knoll? Holy crap. I don't know. Did he have time to come down the sixth floor? So
a question of opinion here. Based on everything that you've heard here and all of your extensive cumulative knowledge and research, is there any even singular element of this weapon that lends itself to being used even in an event that approximates Kennedy's killing, let alone is exactly the same? I mean, I can't think of a single thing that could be argued, certainly in a legal sense, and, you know, and I'm a guy who watches a lot of that legal television, so I don't know how accurate my world is. But are there any elements, if you were taking the devil's advocate approach, that might be an argument to defend this weapon having been used by anybody?
You think of any? $19, and you have a man that doesn't have a lot of money.
if it was, to answer your question, Bob, if it was used, I think it was a diversion to get people to look up there in the hopes that somebody would see somebody standing there. I did a presentation, I don't know, for a couple times now. One of the things that we learned in sniper school is you don't stick the barrel of the rifle outside of an object or a structure because somebody will see that. The idea is you're well back inside the window so that nobody knows where the shot came from. Well, in this case, I think if the rifle was fired at the president, it was for theatrical purposes to get people to look up that direction. As far as accuracy of the rifle, first of all, I would never – if you laid – I always like to use this scenario. Hey, I want you to shoot at somebody, and here's a stack of rifles, and you pick one that you want. I got, you know, a range of rifles and different calibers and different styles. First of all, I wouldn't pick a bolt-action rifle to do any of that. Second of all, if I pick that rifle up, it weighs 8.5 pounds empty, and if the scope is misaligned or if it's, you know, plastic that I can't see through it, I'm not going to use that one. It can only hold 6 rounds and it has to manually be ejected and reloaded. I go, no, I don't want that one either. I want an automatic rifle. I don't necessarily need a scope. Give me something that's of value that's been, you know, guaranteed that it's a good quality rifle. The Cartana would be the last one I would pick. But if I had to pick that, if I was the commander of the field that said, okay, you're going to be up in this location with this rifle, I don't want you to hit anything with it because you probably won't be able to anyway. But make sure you stick it out the window so somebody can see this. And we've got the guy already, you know, we've already got our patsy set up. Just fire it as many times as you can in the direction of the car. That, other than that, I don't think that rifle was ever used to shoot anybody.
Do you think of that scenario, Brian, that there actually these were live rounds that might have been fired as a diversion?
I think there were live rounds fired, yeah.
And so if there were 3-4 of them, you know, I've not heard of any trace of those rounds
being found.
So I'm not arguing the point. I'm just trying to process it.
Yeah, if our shooter was going to fire 3 live rounds at a moving target, and he'd be lucky to hit it once, let alone 3 times, where did those bullets go? We don't know.
So, Brian, are you suggesting that perhaps the rounds found on the sixth floor actually were fired from that rifle?
Well, without having the ability to compare the rifling marks and the tool marks on that, there's no way to know that those even came out of that rifle. But the only thing that connects those two is the same caliber, 6.5, according to the police have, that's the caliber of the gun, and it's the caliber of the bullet shells.
And the photographs that they allege show that the markings are consistent.
Yeah.
But with the exception of the one that looks like it was dented by the end of a screwdriver.
Right.
I mean, there was no possible way that could have held.
That never held a bullet, no.
Right, and it could not. I asked my colleague, the ballistics guy, about that, and I said, is there anything that you can observe or your knowledge of high-powered rifles that would leave a mark that required that amount of force and that preciseness in a brass casing? And he said he was, you know, again, it's one guy, but this is back then. He said he knew of no way that that could be imparted by operating the rifle, even stepping on it, mishandling it. That was, looked like it was done by with the end of a flathead screwdriver.
Yeah, you know, obviously the official story is that it was dented upon impact after ejection.
No. Impact to what? I mean, there's nothing other than brick, and brick against brass. Brass is the winner.
That wouldn't do it. That shell, one, it never held a bullet or a projectile, and two, was that dent was done after it was, if it was fired in that rifle, was done after it was ejected.
Yeah,
right.
It had to be a tool of some kind to make that mark. Because you step on a brass expended cartridge, you're going to smash the whole thing down. You're going to pinch it. This, in that picture, they have the one with a dent. It's a tiny little flat object. I don't know how you do that.
I tried stepping, you know, I at the time weighed 175 pounds, and I tried stepping on my Carcano shell casings, the 6.5s, and I could do no deformation of the shape. They were empty, and I could not deform them. Now, I just stood on it. I didn't jump or do anything unusual.
Yeah.
But in any event, the whole thing just is disturbing at every level. So. Could I ask a personal question? Joe Backus, do you happen to remember working with me
for
a couple of years? Okay. I just was wondering whether my name rang a bell. Joe and I go back to days in Albany and other places. I was cleaning out a whole bunch of my paperwork in refiling it, and I came across some letters from Joe and whatever. We exchanged interesting information.
Joe, where are you now?
What?
Where are you now?
In Albany.
Really? Oh, cool. Okay.
We did something at Albany Law School together, right? Didn't we put on?
Yeah, Mark Zaid. Mark Zaid was a student there.
The lawyer Mark Zaid and you and I, we put on a mini conference at Albany Law School.
Had it more
too. So it's only been 50 years, Joe. But hi.
Well, in other words, he's on my team, and I get some blowback from some people because they don't trust him, and he's actually been so valuable with his DC contacts that I keep trying to explain to these people that, you know, like everything else in life. You work with people on things you can agree with. And regardless of whether, you know, what his opinions are, so far, he's been extremely helpful.
It's interesting how that phenomenon works. Some of you were here maybe a month or two ago when, and I joke with Larry, I'm using the term affectionately, he outed me because I've been a lurker. And Larry decided to say, who's that guy whose video we never see? And so I ended up telling a story, and wouldn't you know it, it was the one time, and I didn't even notice it, that Gary Shaw was attending. And I had related this conference that I had spoken at called Decade of Assassinations back in 1973, and Gary went on to say, I was there and I confirmed it. So we renewed, as I have done here in a minor way with Joe, a relationship that I had with Gary back when I was a member, and I guess I've never not been a member of the original committee to investigate assassinations. And those of you who either knew him or have studied him know that Bud Fensterwald was the core and Gary was involved and so forth. And the whole point of my introductory comment is that in addition to Gary and I renewing, you could imagine that there's pent up 50 years of interesting conversation that we've exchanged a little email on. And one of the conversations was about Bud Fensterwald. So, Larry, when you bring up the things about any individual, you referred to Mark Zaid as one of them. Bud Fensterwald was constantly the subject of, he's a CIA plant.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at his history. That his whole, the scenario of one of many was that he organized the CTIA as a direct result of a request from the CIA as a sponge of misinformation. In other words, a diversionary tactic. And I don't want to go off into a conversation about it other than the anecdote for the three of you running Project JFK is how I completely endorse bringing in new people, new thought, new energy, new research, new points of view, new sets of eyes, all the news. But those of us who go back to the original group, there's threads that tie it all together. And this whole conversation about involvement of intelligence community, and particularly in listening to last week's focus presentation, or the last one you did, David, led me down that path of, you know, and I was very loyal to Bud, and I researched the hell out of him, even though he was a close personal friend, and I could never find any evidence that, but it led to an interesting thing, which was, and I'm just going to stop at the end of this, is that, you know, that Bud and Gary actually had met the day of Bud's death, and Bud was, and yeah. Bud died suddenly, and if you look at his death certificate, it says heart attack, but I mean, guys, it doesn't surprise you that there are people who have other points of view about his death. I have no knowledge of it, but it was so funny that, not funny, but interesting that it came up in a conversation with somebody who I hadn't talked with about this stuff for 50 years.
Gary shared with us that he and Bud were having dinner in Cleburne, and after they came back to Gary's house, I think Bud said that he was not feeling well and decided to take an early flight home, and then he died 3 hours after he got home.
He died at home after getting back in the airport, absolutely. So, and there are several websites you can go to. Oh, my goodness, I'm going to blank on John McAdams' alter ego. Peter, I could look it up, and there's a fellow who has a website similar to McAdams' approach to things. And he has a whole interesting scenario about Fensterwald and how he got home and all of the things that you referred to, Brian. It's certainly something I could tell just in talking with Gary on the phone that still, you know, disturbs him and upsets him to this day. Notwithstanding anything, Bud was a great guy. I mean, he was fascinating, resourceful, understanding, personable, all those good things. But anyway, his legacy is what drives me to this day. And I was also good friends with the third person in the triumvirate, which was Dick Sprague, but Richard E. Sprague.
The computer guy.
The computer guy, the original.
The good one.
The guy, yeah. He's the guy that, if you will, got me started. He and I met. He lived very close to where I was brought up. And he's the guy, by the way, who invented point of sale. So when you go and get your groceries scanned.
Really?
Yeah, that was his claim to fame. And I had explained this before, but he was supposed to give a presentation at an association called the Association for Computing Machinery, and the ACM. It may still today be the professional society for computer types, like the IEEE is to engineers. And they had a meeting here, and he was supposed to come up, and he got sick. And so I got a call from Fensterwald and said, you got to do this. And I already told the story about me public speaking. Just it was oil and vinegar, but I ended up doing it. And it was the personification of the hackneyed phrase, that was the first day of the rest of your life, Bob. So I collaborated with him and Robert Cutler and Ed Berkeley, who was the publisher of Computers and Automation. And so again, I apologize to all of you. I unfortunately don't retain names like I used to, but the gentleman who you had on, David, not too long ago, who had redone the map and the witness list, you know, I had shared in the chat window that I have, you know, the 3x5 architect's type drawings of the Dealey Plaza map that had been done back then by Cutler. And I have them mounted on frames, and I take them with me to presentations. And it gives people a very, even skeptics have a very interesting, comfortable sense of the credibility of research today, which is it's not just a bunch of people singing around in sharing Instagram and YouTube and Twitter. It's legitimate scientific engineering, analytical kind of research. So, but anyway, that whole thing about Fensterwald, when you mentioned Zaid, I remember people saying, who's this Mark guy? And there have been articles, as I recall, Larry, written about him in that, with that complexion of,
I got a comment last week that someone did not want his name on, he did not want the letter to the president on his letterhead.
Huh.
And I said, you know, I could have it. It doesn't matter, but Mark's been great. Mark's the one that knows the guy, the new guy at the NSC. They went to Temple together. I mean, those are the kind of connections that, you know, you could disagree with some views, but, I mean, anyway, some people are really paranoid, and I'm skeptical, you know, but you see if the person is helpful, and so far he's been very helpful.
Some of you who like 60s rock and roll know that paranoia runs deep into your life and will creep. There's a man with a gun out there saying that I better beware.
Right. Even paranoid people could have someone going after them.
Well, what's the response? Come on, Larry. You should say to them, I wouldn't be paranoid if everybody wasn't out to get me.
That's right.
I don't know who that quote is attributed to, but those of you who are chuckling know that it's been around for decades. It's probably some famous 60s orator who said that, or maybe it predates even that. But Brian, I appreciate your professional insights into all this and your research. It's interesting how thoughts that I haven't had, as I mentioned, for decades can be tied together much, much later by bringing new points of view and new information into it. So I encourage continuing to do that, build on the old and generate the new.
Let me throw this out real quick, and then I think David will probably end things for us. But my wife asked me a question probably about an hour ago, and she says, who are all these old guys on there? I said, well...
Was she talking about Larry?
Well, I'm not going to say anything about Larry. You know, I'm not going to do that. The boy just had a birthday. So anyway, I said, that's Joe Backus over there. She goes, do you know him? I said, well, yeah. But I said, the first time I met him, he was a skinny, dark-haired, really good, solid crew cut. And she goes, well, what happened to him? I said, you want to take a look at me and ask me what happened to me? And I said, and David doesn't have any hair. And hell, he was one of my students. Now he's a technician for us. And as for Brian, good God, what the hell happened to your head? And Larry, I'm not in a word.
So you wonder why I have no picture. You wonder why I have no picture on Zoom here, guys, right? But I mean, I've had, to your point, Casey, I mean, it's a little pretentious for me to use the word. I was going to say my protege, but I have a young man. I think I mentioned this. He's a state trooper in New York State, and he is just brilliant. And he has a passionate interest, and we work very closely together. And I think he's going to be the conduit for my experience going forward when I finally are no longer here. But I had to joke with him because he was asking me, if you had to generate like a spreadsheet of generations of JFK researchers, and you had pick, you know, how wide would the generations be, and would it be Gen 0, Gen 1, Gen 2? And he said, well, you must be like Gen 0. And I said, hardly, because I was a 26-something when Mark Lane and, you know, Sylvia Meyer and other people were out there. So it was interesting to see the generations. And then he said, well, how do you put it in perspective today? And I said, I have people coming up to me to ask me questions, and they are the grandchildren of people who heard my presentation in 1970.
Yeah.
The grandchildren.
Yeah.
So maybe
Bob,
we need...
Bob, was he the one that was dating the governor's daughter?
Yeah. I think what you guys need to do then, Casey, instead of being live video, you ought to get really nice, cool pictures when you were cool, suave, you know, Casey hanging around the student union.
Yeah, but Casey was up that way.
Well, then go to Google, select images, and type in cool guy pic, and then put pictures of your younger selves or arbitrary younger people on there, so when spouses, significant others, interested people walk by, they see a youthful, invigorated, whatever. And then we'll leave Brian's regular picture on there because, you know, you got to have one erudite, grandfatherly, you know, type.
Bob, it's a good thing that that we grew up in an age when there were was not the internet, because I know I have a bunch of pictures from the disco days that I would not want those pictures. In fact, I was walking at the Halloween parade a couple years ago with my former wife, and within a block, two guys walked by us wearing the exact seafoam green leisure suit that I used to wear in the disco. And I turned to her and I said, what does it mean that what I used to wear out is now a Halloween costume? And she said, Larry, it means still have good taste.
Larry, we've got those pictures. We're going to wait to post them on the website soon. So we'll see when they come out.
You can imagine how stunned I was during that time when Gary showed the program for that thing, and he said, I want to show you something else, and he put up a picture of me at
home. Really?
Yeah.
We got to see that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm working on it. Remember I mentioned earlier that Gary sent me some negatives? These are negatives. This will date some of you, but from a Kodak Instamatic film camera.
Wow.
And cool. The film was 13 millimeters wide, so even less than a motion picture film, and 17 millimeters in length, and it took 12 or 24 exposures. So imagine the size of these negatives. And he took pictures of all the speakers, names that you all recognize at this conference. And I was asking, you know, I know, David, that you and Gary are working on a project. And so I'm not throwing Gary under the bus here. I thought I would give it a try, and if I didn't have success, I would get the negatives to you. I have a 4800-bit scanner. I believe yours is a 6400-bit. I think you have the Epson 600, and I have the Canon 8800. But I have remarkably been able to recover images from these pictures. They were in a really, really dark room to begin with. So and if you remember the program, I mean, there was Mark Lane and Sylvia Meyer and Gary and just, you know, almost a who's who. And he, even in his graciousness, he sent me the program and he said, you keep it. You were there. You were like in the program and I wasn't. So I'm just bowled over by Gary's, you know, generosity and graciousness. So that's what I'm going to be doing tonight, guys, is working on these negatives. It's tough. You probably know a lot about it, David, but I have to actually work in raw mode.
Wait, does that mean you're in clothes?
No, it's a totally different thing.
Scott, you are really perverted. I have never met you in person, but you really.
I have a shirt that says I shoot in the raw. Or no, I shoot in raw, and my wife won't let me wear that out anywhere because she thinks it's embarrassing. But it's not. It's a camera thing. It's a photography thing.
It is. It's the way that you can capture the most pristine pixels from any image, and then you later process them. The normal way when you capture with a scanner is to capture them in a compressed mode like JPEG. And JPEG in and of itself is not particularly lossy, but you lose that integrated pixel image. And Brian, it sounds like you're an accomplished photographer. So, and the difference is that when I captured it in JPEG, the file was like, I think 150 megabytes when I captured it. It was about 100 megabytes. When I captured it in RAW, it was 3/4 of a gigabyte for 4 frames. So when I process them and then get them into a form that's cropped and all that good stuff, I'll delete the RAW images. But and if it makes you all feel any better now that I know this is going to be posted, I'm on a Zoom meeting, so I'm not wearing pants.
Neither am I.
Remember that there was an error with the Instamatic where you used to get that red dot in your eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, reflected off your retina. And now every modern camera in the last 15 years has got what they call red eye reduction.
Yeah.
And it sort of works. But
yeah. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today.
Bob, I'm in contact with Gary Shaw at least twice a week. And when I call him, I always put doo-wop music behind, And the reason for that is Gary used to sing in a doo-wop band, and I used to sing for the 9th Infantry Division Corps.
And at that time, we did a lot of doo-wop. So when we call and talk to each other, we sing. And I'm sitting there going, good God, how old are we to do this? But I sing first tenor, and he sings second tenor. So
you won't believe this. Quick, Casey, this is the honest to goodness truth. I was a singer too until I lost my voice in college, and I was the only second tenor in a 66 voice choir. It was 66 men. But I'm trying to, in my mind's eye or my mind's ear, wrap my head around listening to doo-wop with a Cleburne twang or draw. That must sound terrific. That's not negative.
And you know that Gary and his group was first approached by Jack Ruby to sing at his club. And they were just high school kids, and they go, I don't think our parents will let us come there, but Jack.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
To show you my perversion. David and Casey.
Well, don't show us your perversion.
No, I'm going to express it.
We got a lawyer here.
Larry, you either are very lonely or spending way too much time by yourself in your office. I live alone and don't think that way. Where I was going with this, David, is you want to come up with a cool event? This is really bizarre. Where is my mind going? Have a JFK related stand-up comedy night.
Oh, God, you know.
I'm sorry. Crickets, can you cut that out of the recording?
No. Well, I'll tell you what. If anybody wants to see what me and Brian and Casey look back in our younger days, you can go salary page, you will see certain photographs of what we used to look like. And I know I get it sometimes where people go on the YouTube channel or on the website and they watch the video when I was 20, and I'm going to be 47 this year, so, you know, 27 years ago, I actually had hair, I wore glasses, no goatee, and I've gotten better with age, but what's kind of funny is about 15 years
ago,
what the hell I look like.
Oh, God, that's Charles Manson's brother. Isn't that Charles Manson?
No, that's what I looked like back in my trucker days.
Wow.
But, you know, I tell you what, what I want to throw out there, and this is for people who's going to be watching this afterwards, the ones that were here, that left early, and the ones that didn't actually even show up for the meeting, but they're going to watch the replay on our website and on YouTube. You know, we start off in one direction, and sometimes we peel off into other directions, and the ones that stick around to the very end get the most interesting discussions that we can possibly have, whether it's, you know, Larry's alter ego of shit to think about and talk about. But I tell you what, though,
God.
Oh, my God, who the hell is that?
Is that Bob?
That's Bob. Yeah, Gary sent that to us too, and I didn't know who it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I go, who's this guy? Why did he take a picture of this guy? We don't. Is this a church?
Are you in a church?
This is at the Georgetown University Law School, and that is, oh my gosh, I'd have to look at the program again. It's not Mark Lane sitting next to me, but it's me with shoulder length hair. And it's in a very dark paneled law school-like auditorium, and it's November 21st, 1973.
You clean up.
That's one of 48 negatives he sent me, so I'm going to hopefully dig out some.
Bob, were you wearing pants that day?
No, but I had my leisure suit with me.
Yeah. Never go anywhere without a leisure suit.
That's right. Well, definitely
had a tie on there. Well, definitely, like I say, I mean, for everybody that, you know, sometimes will come on to the journey meetings and they leave early, or just like when we had the spring conference, I know some people left early on the last day of that. We got into a really good discussion for about the last. We were supposed to stop at, I think, 3 o'clock. We went till around 5:30, 5:45. And those last two and a half hours were not only entertaining, because, God, yeah, they were entertaining, but they were also very informative. And it's things like that, and just like our journey meetings, our regular meetings, not the spotlight series, because that's ran in a little bit more of a tighter form. But, you know, things like this, we get a chance to share stories, talk about different things. That's not really the topic of the day, but, you know, I'm glad we get it on film where people can go back and watch it later on. And just remember, everything that, you know, we talk about in these, they become the historical record, not only of what Project JFK and CSI Dallas is doing, but also the historical record on the JFK assassination. So, you know, I just want to throw that out there that, you know, everybody that you know, we've all got stories, and we've all got tidbits information, and we've all got ideas. So, you know, it's coming together and sharing them is what makes these things very special. So, you know, I guess...
David, this feels like a bunch of guys at a bar late in the night. They've been drinking all night. The difference is, I guess, we're old, and we don't need to drink to get to this point.
Well, I tell you what, I remember having some of the best conversations with, like, Jim Mars after the Lancer conferences. We'd go down to the bar, the rodeo bar at the Adolphus, and we'd start off with a shot each, and then eventually, after about the second or third shot, I got tired of walking over to grab shots for me and Jim, so I just went over and said, just give me the damn bottle. And we would kill a bottle or two of whiskey or bourbon, whatever the hell we were drinking at the time, and we would have some of the best discussions. And that's kind of like what we do with this. Even though, you know, we're kind of at home, we can drink whatever we want. You know, the camaraderie.
Or not wear pants.
Together, not wearing pants. You know, the camaraderie of getting together and sharing this stuff is what this is all about. Plus, you know, getting the information out there to the masses. And I just want to say for everybody that's in attendance still and what's watching this later on in the future date, you know, be sure to, you know, visit the website, projectjfk.com. You know, go and visit the YouTube channel, Project JFK. Hit the subscribe button because that's where people are going to know when new stuff is coming up. They can subscribe to projectjfk.com's list of subscribers. So every time that something comes up that we're doing or we put up new, they get the inside track of knowing that it's up there. So I definitely want to put that out to everybody that, you know, please subscribe. And also if you decide that you want to support us, you know, hit that donate button. Donate what you can. Hell, donate till it hurts. And then donate some more. You know, I want to also throw out there the fact that, you know, we are going to continue doing what we're doing, and we're going to try to make things better each time that we come together and, you know, try to reach as many people that we can. So, let's see, there's something else I was going to go with, but I lost my train of thought in my speaking. So, I'm sure I'll think about it as soon as I end the meeting and go, shit, I should have mentioned that. Oh, I did remember it. Also, visit the affiliated website page, especially for, like, Craig Ciccone, that did the eyewitness map and schematics. I know that, you know, he's got great stuff, and I told him that I would definitely talk about stuff on future shows about him. You can find him on the affiliated website page, just like the Kern Camelot guys that brought out the DVD and Blu-ray, the Doug Horn, Sherry Feaster, and several others were involved in. It's getting the information that some of us maybe don't know that's been out there, or people that, you know, come to us that have no idea what's out there. You know, check out the people that we support, and you know, that's how we get new stuff to come out. So with that, anybody else wants to throw any more tidbits information in, please you know, add to it before we close.
I just make a comment on Joe's contribution to the list. I can't imagine anybody having a shouting match with Dr. Cyril Webb. I mean, that would have been that. I mean, he was, you know, man, he was a force and still is a force. He's a remarkable guy. So,
yeah, and that was there was the ASK conference. The first one was in 1991 in Dallas, and there was like three more of them. and they were held at the big Hyatt Hotel. You see it in views of downtown Dallas. There's a restaurant. It kind of looks like a golf ball on a tee.
Yeah, that's the Hyatt.
At night when you see Dallas. Huh?
That was the Hyatt, yeah.
The Hyatt, yeah. And there was a between, like, the lobby where you're kind of an upstairs bar area. And at one point, Weck shouted up or at them, or he was up on the upper level and down at them. It was a big thing. I think in 92 or 93 or something. People who are there would remember it. But Zabe was hanging out with Gus Russo and Todd Wayne Vaughn for a long time. And Zabe was also like a moderator at one of the Chicago conferences. There were two in Chicago in the 90s, early 90s, I think.
David remembers making reference to the two people behind me in the picture. You couldn't make out their names, but one of them was Bill Turner, William Turner, who, right, the former FBI agent who wrote those fantastic books. Yeah. And the other was, you know, let me see if any of you remember this, George O'Toole. What was his
name? Assassination
tape. Oh, yeah.
Remember, he was the guy who purported to feel there was great credibility of what he calls psychological stress evaluation.
Right.
Yep. He analyzed tapes, not only related to JFK, but to other incidents as well. And the three of us spoke at a session that was called Unique Investigative Techniques. So I spoke about my computer database and photographic stuff, and then those two guys spoke about the other things. So they were, I would believe, the people on the panel there with me.
Yeah, that was one of the first technical books I read, and I thought, well, why didn't somebody do this? Why didn't somebody put this guy on a polygraph machine? Just to, and I, even though you couldn't use it in court, certainly would be interesting to know. But Casey mentioned earlier today that I don't remember who. I think it was somebody mentioned that they had the results of Oswald's polygraph test. Well, I didn't even know he had given a test, but Jack Ruby was given a lengthy polygraph examination in the jail. And in the Warren Commission documents, all you have is the results, the squiggly lines. You got 22 pages of squiggly lines that don't tell you what the questions were. So that's basically useless. But
yeah.
he was given a polygraph, but if Oswald was, well, I've never heard of that.
Right.
Bob, paraffin. Bob, that was me earlier. I found it. It's his paraffin test.
Oh, okay. Not a polygraph.
Paraffin test.
Right. Bob, was that
George O'Toole? Yeah. This is different than a polygraph, Brian. It's
right.
It's called a psychological stress evaluator. Right. I don't remember the details of it now, but I think it's distinct. It's not looking for vital signs
right.
as much as voice. Stress levels and voice and things of that nature, as I recall. O'Toole wrote a book about it. I've got it somewhere in my library.
Yeah, the assassination tapes.
Yeah. There you go. Yep, yeah, that's the book I have.
That's a great book.
It cannot detect a lie, but it can detect the truth through the voice analysis. So it's not a lie detector. It's basically almost like you would say it's a truth detector.
Yeah. It's become so sophisticated now that when I was a private investigator, we had a guy in Memphis that was worked on the Memphis police department. Oh my God.
There you go.
Stop that. Stop that. Oh, don't show it again. It's no big deal, Larry. He didn't say anything. But he said that this so sophisticated stress evaluator, they could do it over a phone call. They could ask five control questions and tell whether the person's lying or not.
Yeah.
If they're not if they're lying, but if there's stress in their voice on a phone call, you could even measure that.
Wow. Tell the truth.
Hey,
yeah.
David, I want to apologize to you. You were trying to gracefully end this meeting, and I had to add one more thing. So I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Who's trying to act gracefully here? Okay, Bob.
Ah!
Hey,
wow.
Who's that?
That's Casey. Let me show that other one of that other guy. Who was that? Oh, my God. That's Elton John.
Wait, he didn't have hair then.
That's Elton John.
That was the first time that I mentioned you had the monk ring going on. So.
Yeah. And she was the first witness I ever met. Yeah.
Yeah, the closest pictures I have are with Mary Woodward.
Me and Ian.
Right there. Oh, Ian Griggs.
Yeah. Well, again, I know we're going to have our we're going to have a meeting again next month, and I do not know exactly who we're going to have for our Spotlight Series speaker. I know who's going to be for August. I've got David Denton scheduled in for a lecture in August. I think it's around the third week, but I'm trying to get somebody lined up for July for us. And definitely, I think Katana Zachary and I forgot her name. What is
Sarah.
It? Yeah, Sarah Peterson. See about getting her to do. See about getting them to do a Spotlight Series. I think they'd be a great addition.
Yeah.
So, like I say, I've got some phone calls to make and some reach outs to do, but definitely, you know, I'm going to try to get it announced as quickly as possible so everybody can show up to the next Spotlight Series meeting. And
if you're going to ask a woman to speak, you better not. You may want to wait posting this video on the website because, you know, talking about clothes and people's pants, and that might scare them away.
We want to rerun a clean website here.
The without pants phenomena started a year and a half
ago. No details.
No, I don't mean with me. I mean with just men and women on Zoom meetings. I think it may have originated with women. I'm just saying it's almost part of the conventional experience now.
Yeah, there was a teacher in California that was not only was he drinking. They could tell he was drinking because his camera was pointed at a mirror behind him, and he had like two or three beer cans sitting out, and he wasn't wearing pants. He really wasn't wearing pants.
Well,
he got drunk, and he started going in on the school board, and they did some more research and said, you know, we don't need to know that you're not wearing pants, but the drinking while you're in the Zoom meeting, that doesn't sit too well. So keep your beer out of the way. Nobody will see it.
So one final thought for you guys.
Did you do this?
Well, Bob, if you could still do that at your age, congratulations.
You know, Larry, I was going to suggest that at some point we should meet, but I'm having second thoughts. And it has nothing to do with the pandemic.
All right, guys, I'm going to get off here, but I'm going to turn it back over to David. And it's a very interesting meeting, and we always come up with some good stuff. So thank you guys for tuning in. Go ahead, David.
All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and bring this July 10th, 2021 journey meeting to an end. It has been fun. It's been informational. And you know what? It goes viral. Well, I wish the shit would go more viral than what it has. But I tell you what really impressed me was when we started getting over 400 hits on Dr. Newman's presentation. So. You know, it just goes to show there's a lot of people that's interested in what we're doing, and I hope they continue with their interest and seeing what we put out there. And, nothing else, with the journey meetings, you do get the good laughs. So, especially when you get Bart Camp to come in and talk about, the UK slang. So,
thank you for your leadership, guys. Appreciate it.
Well,
I think Bart still hasn't paid all his bills. You can see them still hanging up on the wall.
And I think the gentleman, Chuck, got some really quality sleep time.
Yeah. I'm glad we were able to help him out with that. Like leaving your TV on for white noise.
Some people would argue that what they're listening to now is the equivalent of white noise.
Yeah.
So. Oh.
Hey, some people would argue that.
Yeah.
I'm contributing to it, so I'm not arguing. Mine's pink noise.
David, I think we better leave before we get into any further trouble.
I think we're going to go and bring this to a close. So I want to thank everybody again. And, you know, we'll see you next time on the Journey meeting, and we'll see you very soon on the Journey Spotlight Series. So,
and if anyone ends up in jail because they weren't wearing clothes or something, I'm not the lawyer to defend you. All right,
so don't stand up again until we get off the line.
Okay, guys.
Okay.
Everybody take care.
Take care. Be healthy, everyone.